Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
T-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to 2013. Rolling right into it with this first Weekend Confirmed of the year on a decidedly odd note from the pre-show warm-up. You should watch the video where we've been talking about Zima and peanuts. And not peanuts, the kind that you'd get at the bar with Zima, but peanuts, the kind that are on your television during the holidays. Because I don't know why. Because we just got sidetracked on those things. So it's going to be a sophisticated episode.
It's definitely going to be something different.
Something different for you. And that's Jeff Cannata here to my left.
Happy to be back for a new year.
And anything special happen over the holidays? You have a good time?
I had a great time. I did. I had a wonderful holiday.
I feel like we just dropped into the delicious dish. So
I enjoyed that.
Tell us about it.
Some balls.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of my favorite balls. Treats for the holiday time is...
They're sweaty.
Oh, just put one in your mouth. Yeah, that's really good.
All right, then. So also next to him by listener demand, back because, well, we like her too. Nicole.
Well, that's nice. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm waving.
No one can see that. No one can see that.
I'm letting them know I'm waving.
I like your wave was so affected. It was the...
They can't see!
I vote that we initiate 2013 by naming Nicole a permanent regular.
A regular permanent?
Yes.
Regiment?
Can I get a second?
I second the motion.
Thirded.
All in favor? Nicole,
all opposed?
Nicole didn't vote.
I didn't know it was an option for me.
Well, sure, right. Vote yourself in.
We're putting you down as an A.
Well, that's still, you still got on, though.
Oh, God. Okay, thank you.
So 2013, off to a great start already. And Jeff Mattis there at the end of the table.
Yes, Happy New Year, everyone. Happy New Year.
Darn it, two Jeffs and a Nicole walked into a bar. I don't know what that'll happen. Anyway, I want to also...
And many Zimas were consumed.
Yeah.
Needless to say, the bar was empty a few hours later. Also, I want to give a big shout out to our listener, Eric, who introduced himself to me in the gym at my apartment complex over the holidays.
At apartment complex?
Yeah.
He lives in your apartment complex?
No. So he lives
in the gym?
No. He actually lives like 20 miles away. He just happened to be in my laundry room.
No, he was under my car. It was very strange. But
I want to thank him because it was in the midst of having read the threads and responses to the first show, which sometimes turn a little negative.
Sometimes.
And I was like in one of those moods where I was like, God damn it. Like, all I try to do is like make this show as good as it can be. And then there's always gonna be someone who's got to make me feel like an asshole about it. And then Eric came up and he was like super nice, introduced himself, was just like, hey, I'm listening to you right now on the holiday show. I'm like, this is fucking amazing. Huh. It was really cool. So Eric, thanks. I really appreciate
that.
Why
was he in your building?
So he lives in Hawaii, where he...
It's getting weird.
Where he rehabilitates coral reefs, which is really fucking cool work, by the way. That is really cool. And if I remember correctly...
It's like, you're better than this coral reef. You're better than this.
You believe in yourself.
Come on.
It's reefer madness.
If I remember the relationships right, his sister... lives in like the, well, I live in one of these massive complexes over here in the marina. So it's not like there's like 1,000 people that live in those buildings anyway, right? So I think he was like visiting his sister or maybe his brother's.
Let me ask you this question, Garnett.
Yes.
You see fan of the show in gym. Do you add a few pounds to the weights that you're lifting? Do you ramp it up a little bit?
I just finished my warm up.
you're like six.
38.
39.
You're such an asshole because you know that's true.
You're like, oh, hey, Eric, I was just adding some more weight to this.
You so know that's true, don't you? Because you've done the same thing.
It's possible.
Because you've done the same thing. You're like, oh, dumbbells. Yeah, I'm getting bigger ones. I always do 50s on my curls.
Yeah, I'd be lifting a lot more if I didn't pull this truck uphill by myself.
Ending my workout? No, I'm just going to a different place for more workout. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like bar hopping, except for...
Yeah. I don't want to have my entire workout in one location.
All right, so we've got a fresh year, but there aren't a lot of fresh games. We still have a lot to talk about, and I want to start us off, before we dive into games, with a retread story that Andrew Yoon and I were talking about because it came back up after a NeoGAF sleuth, his name's GoFreak, found a link to a patent that Sony has filed or potentially refiled. We were looking into whether or not it was just a refiling because... Rewind here for a second. Remember when the PS3 was coming out and there was that
boomerang controller?
Sorry.
People don't like vibrating controllers.
Which, by the way, reminds me of this funny, like, the Blu-ray controller for the PS3 is still a problem because my friend Shane Satterfield, who's over at Game Trailers, was complaining over the holiday that he got a new Harmony remote, which is one of those remotes, you know, that controls all your shit, except it can't control his PS3 Blu-ray player because it only works on infrared stuff. So he's like, it's kind of freaking annoying. Anyway, remember back when PS3 was coming out and there was the whole story about how Sony was looking into ways to prevent you from selling or trading games, or you know games would be tied to your console. It's back. Not surprisingly. I mean, the rumors have been floating around about Xbox Next or whatever it's going to be, and Orbis PS3 for whatever PS4 having it. But this patent filing from September of 2012 essentially describes a RF tag system. So you're familiar with RF tags? Those are the radio frequency tags they can put inside like your credit cards and stuff, and then they use a near field reader, which like gives enough power to like suck the data in and out of the thing, and it can like tag, you know, exchange data with the tag. Well, so they put one of these in a game, and now your game, when it's connected, when you drop it into your machine, it can immediately charge up the tag and say, okay, this is the first time this game's ever been used, and I'm imprinting it with the code for Jeff Kanata's PS4, and that's the system it'll play in.
Bullshit. That's total
it
bullshit.
It totally grosses me out.
Imagine if they did that for movies.
I think they probably want to.
They probably do. But I mean...
Then I'm not going to legally buy your movie.
That's so anti-consumer.
Limit me like that. Yeah, especially since...
Well, you don't own it. You only own the exclusive lease on that data.
For games?
For all media. You don't actually own it. You own the right to view it.
Or play it.
Right. Or play it. Yeah.
But like, the publishers have released consoles, that, especially Microsoft, that break... Like, in the beginning, how many people went through multiple Xbox 360s?
Oh, so keep in mind that the beauty of the RF tag system is that it's rewritable. So it wouldn't be indelibly written. They would be able to give you control over. So say your console, you know, fails, they would be able to give you a rewrite of the disc and reapply it. So they would be able to handle, of course, on a situational basis, any sorts of problems like that cropped up. Mm-hmm. They could also potentially do a system where they could perhaps sell you an unlock. So say you buy it. So like, keep in mind now, here's how it, think of it from a publisher standpoint. I make a $60 game. I don't get any revenue off of the used games unless I charge you $5 to unlock the RF chip to sell it back.
Which is what they're doing now, kind of, with newer games with online passes. If you buy the game, you're going to have to pay to get access to the multiplayer or with like Arkham City,
right?
Access Catwoman or whatever the exclusive features are.
Except that the difference there is that the person buying the used game suffers the penalty, whereas here the person who bought the game firsthand still has to pay extra to unlock it for the next person. Or I guess you could still
do
it the other way, I guess. Yeah.
Does parent company Gamefly crap its pants at this news?
You know, I don't think that... I don't actually know. I mean, I can't speak for Gamefly because I work on the editorial and publishing side. But, I mean, these things have come and gone, and doesn't a good rental business help the games business?
Well, if everything is moving to digital, right, this digital rights management, you know, that they're this new thing that they're proposing really doesn't have that much of an impact anymore.
Maybe.
Because you don't – I mean, there
is
no –
We're not moving there that soon.
No, I know. But, I mean, I think that's – those two worlds will come together, and you'll basically have the digital environment where nobody's really figured out a great way to, you know, trade used digital
or rent
digital titles.
Look, that's got to happen. Think about how many games Gamefly and Redbox buy.
Yeah.
And does Blockbuster – well, Blockbuster still rents games, don't they?
Does Blockbuster exist?
Still. Yeah. There's like 12. They're all in Florida.
Not in my name.
Who had Got Game inside their building? Was that like
that was game? That was Blockbuster.
Game Crazy.
Oh, Game Crazy.
I don't know. Anyway, but all those places.
Game Rush,
anybody,
I think.
Anybody that's going to rent games has to buy a shit ton of games. So you're selling a bunch of games, but then that's back to that same thing of people of the publisher feeling like, well, we're not making all the money we ought to be. It's a really, as many friends as I have in the game development business who always, every time this subject comes up and I defend being able to, you know, have bought a game and then trade it as you want to, get mad at me like, oh, we don't make any money off of that. But you make money off the firsthand sales. Mm-hmm. And that's what you did. You made the game. And if your game is great, people will go out and buy it. And
Well, don't you think that also has something to do with the pervasive, our game has to have multiplayer?
Because, oh, absolutely.
You know, you can play through the single player and pass it along, sell it back, etc. But if you have a ongoing multiplayer, you're going to reduce some of those.
Or expansion packs even, just single player downloadable content like that. That's compelling.
There are far, far, far better ways to get us engaged in keeping games and not trading our games and not selling. But at the end of the day, look, it still comes down to the other part of the problem, which is that $60 games are still just way too expensive. They're way too expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, New Year, same topics. I mean, it's the same shit we've been saying for years.
And it's all relative, right? Because I think we'd all agree that, I mean, I wouldn't have a problem paying $60 for Skyrim or Red Dead or a game that I felt. But then you compare it to a, you know, 4 or 5 hour experience that may not even have this, even be close to the level of quality. And then you're basically like, oh my gosh, there's such a disparity between this $60 title and this $60 title and what I got for my money that... That creates part of the problem, right?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, there is no gradation in there. It's like just straight up your $60 like, or your budget or your digital or whatever.
Do you feel like – I feel like things have really regressed in the past few years of this generation as well, because I felt like there was a time there in the PS2 era especially, and maybe in the middle part of this era, where there might have been some willingness by publishers to try a middle ground price tier. But when was the last time you saw a mid-tier priced retail box game? When was
Torchlight 2?
Walking Dead just came, but that was...
I'm talking about walked into a store and saw...
I think Epic Mickey was $50 rather than $60.
Because they had a Wii version.
Yeah.
But I mean, when was the last time you walked into the store and saw a $40 game or a $30 game, a $30 or $40 PS3 360 game?
I think THQ tried it with MX vs. ATV, where they sold you the a la carte version.
You know what? You're right. They did.
THQ had some great ideas. They still have great ideas.
Yeah, it's not really going so well for them.
But yeah, I mean, they tried that model. I think it was a $40 base game, and the more you liked it, the more you paid for it.
That's a hard business model to sell, though, when everybody else is doing
sure,
especially
with MXATV.
Yeah, exactly. And the game.
But here's the model we look at today, is that everybody tries to go at $60, and then when it doesn't work at $60, they shit-can the development studio and throw the rest of the copies out to the wolves at $15 or $20 and just write it off as a loss. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That is a ridiculous. Who sits down at their board meeting and says, okay, here's the plan. If it works, then great. We'll make a shit ton of money. If it doesn't, we'll fire everybody and we'll just take a loss on it.
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous that it happens that way. But nobody's got it figured out yet. You know, and the landscape's changing so fast. Like I said, this digital thing, I think, has people sort of, even though it's not coming tomorrow, it's going to play a much bigger role than it is now. And every day it continues to play a bigger role. And I think that's got people figuring out how do we, you know, capitalize the most, make the most off of our games. The problem is if you add, you know, on disk DRM and then you eliminate try before you buy by proxy. Or, I mean, I guess you could still release game demos. But if you're not letting people sample this $60 product that you're just saying, hey, you buy it. And once you buy it, it's yours and you can't resell it. You can't, you know.
You can't go downstairs and let your brother play it because he has to use your Xbox.
Well, yeah, even more. Yeah.
I wonder if more people are going to try the Skylanders technique of sort of adding products to the experience and making this physical thing that you want to have that's almost a collector's item that, you know, that I think that that's something
but
that
children's
has,
games
has,
especially. I mean, that could work in all kinds of models.
Dude,
they
I would
have
be,
toys.
But wouldn't you be into that in other games where it fits?
For sure. Yeah, I think
my
that's
little a D&D figures.
I mean, any way that it, that
if I was playing a Zone of the Enders game and I could have like a frame and like the frame would somehow relate to what's going on, that would be cool as shit.
Right. And any way that they can mask that desire in a feature rather than, you know, in something that, yeah, exactly. Something that, right. that I want and that I'm looking for. And I mean, I think, you know, they tried that with the sort of collector's edition sets to get squeeze extra money out of you because you're getting your cat helmet and all that stuff. Right. And I guess that comes from the same motivation, but what Skylanders is doing is so interesting and so fun and I think has caught on in such an interesting way. It'll be interesting to see in 2013 how that influences other games and other designers.
I think it's a great model. It's really working for them, but it is very particular. Like you need to have the right game and the right sort of tchotchkes to sell for it. And
I just can't get past
the feeling. Any role playing game you could theoretically.
I think children are more inclined to have a bunch of toys scattered around them. Not that I don't have toys and crap, but I probably wouldn't want to have a ton of accessories for my game.
Well, right. maybe there's another way to do it that works for you.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I don't know what it is. We haven't thought that through. Obviously, we're off the cuff a little bit.
So if somebody, this is just an idea, but somebody has a Mass Effect-like game that is basically uses Skylanders tech, and for your party member, you put, you know, you got your little dude, and he's like 6 inches tall, and when you put a new gun in his hand or a new piece of armor on him or a new helmet or whatever, it actually, you know, affects what's going on in game. Like your in-game character now has a helmet on or whatever.
Okay, now that
when you say it like that, it sounds silly.
it does.
I started getting a 40-year-old virgin flashback.
Yeah, like, oh god. Right.
Far Cry 3 expansion, the voodoo doll.
Right.
You stab it, and then that character dies.
Voodoo Vince 2, motherfuckers.
And let me clarify: that idea was not this is awesome. Yeah. This is something that I want. This is look, you know, there are only so many things you can do with plastic toys and games, you know.
But back to games being, or consoles not being able to play used games, like I don't think that we're going to see that next generation, only in that it's going to shut down GameStop and publishers need GameStop.
You're right.
They have exclusives through them. They have pre-order bonuses through them. They have promotions through them.
It's a love-hate.
And then they hate us.
They want to say hate, but here's the dirty secret. And I've talked about this before from having been in that business. And even though it was years ago, I've watched the way they operate. It hasn't changed anymore. The business of selling new games is dependent upon pre-orders because pre-orders get the other big retailers to buy in. And GameStop drives its pre-order business with the used game business. In other words, the way they get you, Jeff, to keep ordering your games is that every time you go in and buy a new game, they remind you that when you get done with it, if you trade it in, you can trade it in towards whatever you want to pre-order next. And when you trade it in to pre-order something else, they give you bonus credit. So let's say your game's worth $15 or some piddly amount when you trade it in. But if you trade it in towards BioShock Infinite, we'll give you $30. And so they're juicing their pre-orders that way.
And is there anything else you'd like to pre-order today?
Exactly.
Did you know that
there's a new Halo coming out at some point someday?
Yeah.
Eventually.
Exactly. Here's my $5.
So the publishers want to have that high consumption business, right? That's the high churn user who's like buying a game, burning through it super fast, trading it in so they can pre-order the next game, trading it in so they pre-order the next game. The part they don't like is that those games get traded in pretty quickly and then get bought in the secondhand market instead of the primary market.
And make a game that people can't get rid of quickly.
Well,
that's what everybody's trying to do.
Or you've got a game that's generating a lot of great momentum. I mean, look, it's all part of the same. Like when we were younger and we were around friends like at playtime all the time, weren't you sharing games all the time?
Yeah.
Sharing games was another big way that you spread stuff. And like if you can't share your games easily, like if it had to be Timmy needs to come over to my house because he's got to log into my PS3 with his PS3 account so that we can play his game because
Garnet, you and Ariel is a perfect example, right? You guys both have your own home consoles.
Yeah.
You had to basically pay like an extra thing to unlock so you could play it in either system. I mean,
so you're talking about Borderlands 2?
Well, no, that you need an extra. I'm just talking about anything you buy, right? And you're like, okay, I just played this really awesome little thing and it's a single player game and. Oh, Ariel,
you're right.
You have to come play it on my machine because I can't.
Or with my login.
Or pay whatever it is, $10 to.
Hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, and that's what, because I live with my brother, so that's how we share games. Like, we decide, I'll buy this one if you buy this one. And then after he finishes that one, I trade. And that would completely ruin our economy. I mean, our personal, like, the two of us economy.
Well, I think, again, to me, the financial struggle comes back to this wrong-minded mentality of it's either a $60 game or it's a $15 downloadable title, and everything has to be a big hit. And I just don't – I think that that's where the core fallacy comes from. That's where the problem comes from.
Well, the people the people that are making the price decisions are not looking at the material that they are – they're just like, okay, this is –
here's how much we spend.
This is how much
money we want to get back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is a AAA title. Boom. This is a low budget title because we spent 6 months worth of cash and revenue on it, and you know it's a really low overhead.
You're not going to save a Hitman Absolution by slapping an RFID tag on the disc and making it more difficult for the consumer to trade it or sell it used or whatever. You're going to save it by having it marketed and priced into the right spot. It wasn't going to be a competitive $60 game for whatever reason, right? I mean, Hitman Absolution, I'm not crapping on Hitman Absolution. I just like pulled an example that I don't think sold particularly well right. during the holidays mm-hmm. and faced tough competition, but seemed to be a kind of cool game, but not a super long experience. And yet it's still a high production value experience. And so we've got to have publishers thinking about ways to create business models for those sorts of games that work for everybody, that work for the developer to make money, that work for the publisher to be successful, and work for the consumer to be able to go out and buy those games in the right way through the right channels and enjoy them.
Yeah, what I was thinking as you were saying that was that in the universe you described, which is driven by pre-order and hype and pre-release buzz and all that stuff, I think there's certainly a perception, and I don't think it's wrong, that you announce a game as a mid-tier title and it loses some of that hype. So what I kind of came to in just spitballing here, but what if there was a universe in which, you know, pre-order incentive was pre-order it at a lower price? You know, like, I don't know. I'm not a freaking marketing guy.
But. No, there are things you can do. I mean, the reality is not all games are created equal, and they shouldn't be treated as such. Like, you know, there are definitely business things, money and time and energy and resources that go into every game.
But
and
people have been saying the same thing about movies for a long time. I mean, there's been a big movement to try to tier the price of going to the movies.
Well, and when you add stuff like 3D and you add stuff like...
Well, it sort of has happened.
It has happened.
But it also was the big push several years ago was to try to do that just based on... title of movie, just based on
how much
a small romantic comedy
versus the Avengers,
right? Exactly, big. But the problem was it was go up rather than come down.
Yeah, it's like the opposite.
You know, if the big ones that people are lining up around the block to go see are going to cost you $20-$25 to get into, whereas the romantic comedy only costs you $10.
Well, there comes a point at which, as a studio, whether you're making a game or a movie, you have to go, you know what? Maybe it isn't profitable to spend $500 million making something and then trying to recoup that profit.
But that's the problem. I want the things that cost $500 million to make. I get excited about the things that cost $500 million to make. I love high production quality, and I love bleeding edge tech. So I want Sony to make the PS3 with all the whiz-bang technology of the time.
At the same time, you realize that not every movie will be that.
Right.
And that there has to be some sort of, just because you want to make the next Call of Duty or you want to make the next Titanic, there's no guarantee that you know.
I want all those things as well.
But saying we're going out and we're going to compete with Call of Duty. I mean, I guess the biggest example we can come up with is like the old 2K football game, which came out at $20.
The last was their last gasp attempt to like really take a shot. And they sold a shit ton of it.
They did. Not enough to keep it going.
Well, because they lost the license.
Yeah, right.
NFL went on their little like, well, we think the NFL license would be better treated by having one football game.
Man. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that I think that when you come out and you say we're going to compete with the big dog, but we're going to do it at a lower price, it's a mixed message to the consumer of going that we're as worthy as these guys, but we're not worth as much because you don't have to pay as much.
But here's the thing is, Nick, now we're making this argument that people make this decision about the caliber of the game without playing it, which is kind of like...
People do that all the time.
Beforehand, but once the game comes out, if the game is like... priced at $30 or $40 and it's a freaking awesome experience.
But you're the one who just said it's all about pre-orders. It's all about...
Okay, I understand that. So that's why I'm saying a more sustainable model. Instead of this slash and burns deal, instead of this like, I'm going to give it 2 weeks at $60 and if it doesn't sell, I'm firing the entire studio and slashing it to $20 and getting rid of it. How about...
Well, because from their perspective, I mean, I'm not defending this. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. And from their perspective, they want to make the game that sells a shit ton at $60. And if those guys delivered that and it didn't work...
What if I sell two shit tons at $40?
Right, but... what they wanted was this. They didn't deliver it, so they fired everybody.
But here's the thing is, like, that's what I'm saying is you're not always making that game. You're not always making that big experience. Like, you know what I don't need to hear? I don't need to hear Tomb Raider multiplayer. That's what I really didn't need to hear over the Christmas holiday.
Especially the developers who could be doing Thief 4. Like, that's what you're doing? Well, you could still be doing Thief 4. We just don't know. But it's like, No one's asking for that.
What is about like 30% of the multiplayer games out there actually need multiplayer? Like
it's the online pass now. Like, now they need to charge something.
It doesn't. Yeah, rarely ever benefits the game though. Like it does in some cases, but it's usually just a here's another mode. Like,
and there are probably some great people working on it. I just have to say that reveal feels as much as any ever has of a, we felt like we had to put something on here to keep you from trading in Tomb Raider after you finished it. And that is exposing the problem.
We just got, I mean, I have to point out that we just got done saying, well, make the game a game that I don't want to trade in. And that's what they're trying to do. I mean, that's the opposite of the RFID.
Well, they're trying to treat the symptom with a imperfect cure, which is slapping in a unnecessary
Well,
mode.
What's the perfect cure then?
Well,
in Tomb Raider's case.
In Tomb Raider's case, what's the perfect
cure? In a finite single-player game.
Adding single-player DLC. Adding more content to the single-player experience.
Yeah, I agree.
Make me have to save my file.
So then you get it. Now we're down the road of there's content that was going to be in the game, but we held it back because we want to have release, you know.
I'll do you one better.
Like, two months later.
Tomb Raider comes out. It's a 6 to 7 hour single player experience. They sell it for $45. And then they release DLC at $15-$20 a pop that is actually full featured, another 3-4 hours, 5 hours of content in each little chunk. And
sell it to me in $3 $15 chunks. I don't know. Like,
well,
I think
Skyrim
the episode like,
sold me for $60, and then they kept selling me DLC for $20. I probably put like $100 into Skyrim.
And in all due deference to Tomb Raider,
well, okay,
Skyrim is a considerably larger endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, you can compare it to the grand success story of right. that model and a game that
and
that
Tomb Raider is a huge
conducive
investment.
To that.
Tomb Raider is a huge investment this time out because they have a new engine that they've been working on. They've obviously put a tremendous amount of work into it, so they have to figure out how to recover that. Well, what if Tomb Raider is successful and you can make 2 or 3 more Tomb Raiders on that same engine and use that same, like that begins the new franchise?
You mean Assassin's Creed?
See, yeah, it's like, it seems somewhat short-sighted to be, oh, well, we have to be successful with just this one. I mean, this Tomb Raider, obviously, you've got Tomb Raider name behind it, and you can sell a bunch of them at $60, and so it's a difficult argument that
I'm making here. I threw out Assassin's Creed in a kind of snarky way, but the more I think about it, the more they are doing exactly what you're saying. They put out a game, they put out DLC for that game, then they put out another game in that engine, and they do that 3 times, and they put out the new big numbered sequel, and they put out DLC for that, and they put out...
And multiplayer.
And each of those is going to be $60, because why the fuck would they charge you less?
I would say that Assassin's Creed is the one that the publishers look to and say, why can't we do that?
Right.
And the answer is that the Assassin's Creed games are, they established the engine and then made themselves a process to make them. But they're talking, you know, you're talking teams of upwards of 200 people to make those games.
Multiple teams
over multiple years of development.
I have to be clear to the listeners that I'm not arguing in favor of raping the consumer. I'm just trying to present the alternate perspective here, because everything that we say, it's like, oh, well, there's people doing that, and there's really
no means no.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I think the problem is that we still haven't figured out how to find new product pipelines and new ways to bring games to customers and or player gamers. I call them customers. I don't know why.
Player gamers.
I'm thinking about like publisher, but someone's got to find new ways to bring game content to gamers that works for everybody and doesn't create these situations too, where it's either the one out of every so often successes or a bunch of catastrophic failures that puts everybody out of business, because that's not good. It's not healthy. It's not good. Wow, what a weird ending to the first segment of 2013.
It's not.
All right,
good.
We come back on the other side. We will hop into some of the games we've been playing over the break and some of the things you've been talking about. Stick around. Weekend Confirmed. We'll be right back. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from shacknews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Weekend Confirmed in the Gamefly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. Oh, Dave, rocking the old version of that with the and palm mobile devices.
Who has a palm
what the hell
mobile?
Is that, Dave? Come on. We really have to cut a new ad for that app. It's like
on your Newton Defias.
We're looking at someone would be looking at the GameFly app and be like, man, this motherfucker is like 3.5. What's he talking about? 2.
Get the new version of the GameFly app and find out what we're playing
on your flip phone.
On your Razor.
The Motorola Razor.
Oh dear, the Motorola Razor. Hey, one of the things that people gave in the feedback, which I thought was, well, there was one person who wrote this. They didn't want us to talk about MMOs.
Fuck that. What am I doing here if I can't talk? Hey, fuck you, guy.
All right.
I mean, there's always somebody that doesn't want to talk about something. It's
Jeff,
like, you know.
Jeff Cartmanata.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, did he have any reason for it? I mean, that's a video
game. He
doesn't
like him,
and we
I'm
talk
sure.
about video
I'm sure
games.
I don't like him, so I don't want
to. Well,
hear
we should
about
cater
it.
To him.
So people don't want me to talk about board games and MMOs, and I'm like, well, then why do I show up?
Dude, you play a lot of games.
I do.
You play a lot of
like
games.
Like Terra?
Yeah, oh my God.
And so here's a question I want
15
you...
15 levels over the Christmas break.
As we talk about MMOs through this section, I want you guys to think about this question in the back of your minds. What do you think is going to happen to the MMO space over the next year? Because it seems to me to be as stagnant as RTS was a few years ago, or you know, real time or RPGs had gotten at one point, and you know, shooters haven't really gone through this yet, I guess, but a lot of genres have gone through this period where you know they were being super popular and then they really really stagnate, and I mm-hmm. feel like MMOs have really reached that point of super stagnation, yet we still have some juggernauts in the wings. Who knows how far down the line? Mm-hmm. There's the Blizzard project that we don't know anything about yet.
Yeah,
and there's still you know, Nicole's played like how many hours did you say you played of Skyrim?
220 hours of Skyrim.
And yet there's the Elder Scrolls MMO still en route. So, yeah. And we've seen some Wasteland. So I want you guys kind of think about that, like what needs to happen in the MMO space? Where can it go? What can it do to make itself vital again? Because it's vital enough for you playing Terra.
Yeah, I'll just briefly recap again why I got back into Terra, because I played a lot of it over the break, like I said, 15 levels, and what's happened is Dan, Alex, myself, and my good buddy from college, Jerry, we all have characters and we're all leveling them up together, and we've got you know, Dan's a healer, Jerry's a tank, Alex and I are DPS. So we have our set group. When we queue for dungeon finding, we get instantly in because we have a set. All we need is one more DPS to pop us in and make us a group. We're good to go. We're leveling up. The game is gorgeous. But we are completely ignoring every bit of lore, every bit of quest. We are literally just grabbing all the quests we can, killing 10 of these and 15 of those and 5 of these and running.
Right.
So it is really, we are breaking it down to its component parts of just hanging out with our buddies, being in a place that's really beautiful, and a combat system that's super fun. And that's really why I'm playing that game. The most beautiful MMO on the market. Every new area we go into, we're like, oh my God, look at this. It's the Unreal Engine. It's stunning. It is really, really pretty. And the combat system is fun. The game has a lot of flaws. There's a lot of things I don't like about it. There's a lot of things about Guild Wars 2 that I wish were in this game that make it seamless. I've talked about a lot on the show. But there isn't any other... I mean, I think this is what people like about Call of Duty multiplayer or Halo multiplayer or whatever their particular genre is when they get their group of buddies or Dota or whatever it is that they do that's a multiplayer experience where they can get on with their buddies and it's like playing a pickup game of basketball down at the, you know, park. You're hanging out with your buddies. You're all doing something. You're complimenting each other's abilities, you know. And it really isn't like playing video games. It's more like hanging out with my friends. And MMOs do that really well. And I don't – and as much as they are stagnant in a lot of ways, I think – in retrospect, looking at what Star Wars did of trying to make it more of a single player experience kind of misses the point. You know?
I mean, two things. A, I loved SWTOR so much.
Are you still playing it?
I'm not. But
how long did you play it?
Got to level 45.
Okay.
So and if you type like slash hours or something, I was in like 6 days. Like I played a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of SWTOR. I have a Mac and there's no Mac version of SWTOR, so it was a lot of borrowing PCs and that just wasn't an option for me. So that's basically why I stopped playing. But for Terra, I think what you touched on with playing with your friends, it's like that's probably the number one thing that keeps people playing games is having or MMOs, having someone to play with. And that's the one thing that publishers can't, they have no control over.
Right.
They have no control over if your best friend's playing it or not. But it's probably the most important factor for an MMO.
Oh, for any multiplayer game.
If they can buy your friends, that's...
Well, I mean, that's why there are these, you know, top tier two or three shooters that whose multiplayer rules the roost because everybody's playing that, so I want to be where everybody's playing.
Everybody has a friend, at least... Yeah. Any given night, I can sign on to my Xbox, and I have at least four people playing Black Ops 2. If I wanted to play that with someone, I have someone to play that with.
Right.
Terra, not so much.
I love it.
Although now I know I have some friends.
But you're playing LOTRO.
I'm playing LOTRO right now. It's free to play.
Yeah.
In the base level, there are expansions you can buy, and there's obviously an in-game store and all that. But it's one of the very few games that I can play on my Mac, so I was really excited about that.
I like how your decision process on what you're going to play is.
What can I play on my Mac?
That's it, though, because I don't have room for a desk, so I don't have room for a PC, so I have a Mac laptop. I mean, that's all I can...
You know there's PC laptops, right?
But you know...
Yeah, but I mean, I don't have a job, so I feel like that's probably not where my money should go.
Are you free to playing LOTRO, or are you buying microtransactions?
I'm free to playing right now. I'm only like level 10 or 11.
Oh, so you started from the beginning.
Yeah.
So what got you to pick it?
My brother was playing it, and he convinced me to play it. He's like level 50, so I can't play with him.
It's a house economy issue.
Yeah. Well, it's free, so it's like perfect economy.
Yeah.
But, it's a really basic MMO. I mean, from what he says, when you get to like Riders of Rohan expansion and that kind of gameplay, it's a lot more lore and a lot more story. Right now, I'm basically doing the whole kind of kill six wolves in MMO style gameplay.
MMOs,
yeah,
yo.
But that's... Yeah. But I'm an elf, and I get to fight dwarves, and I get to go in mines, and it's that basic fantasy MMORPG thing that kind of keeps me playing games.
Plus, like Gandalf, am I right?
Yeah, he's right.
Like,
a lot of hobbits.
Totally right.
You can play as a hobbit, which is, you know, a thing.
Nicole does have a little bit of a thing for Lord of the Rings.
I have a thing for elves.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just fair. Elves in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, in thinking about what would make MMOs vital again, I'm not sure that it's just free-to-play. So,
I agree.
Lord of the Rings seems to be the one that everyone points to as, look at how well it worked for Lord of the Rings, because it was a premium MMO when it launched, mm-hmm. and it did okay. It wasn't setting the world on fire. It had a good core fan base, but it wasn't punching up to what they thought was its weight. When they took it free to play, it did suddenly start to really build an even stronger and much more engaged player base. And look, now here we are. Lord of the Rings is, what, 5 or 6 years old now?
At least. Well, is any part of you picking that up again due to the fact that Tolkien's back in the zeitgeist?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
It didn't hurt.
Yeah.
No.
Didn't hurt, but then low friction because it's free to play, so you can get into it easily.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not making a financial investment. I don't have to. I'm not playing with anyone in particular, so I'm not making any kind of friendship investment. It was kind of just, I want to try something new. This seems easy and low maintenance. I can just download it from Steam and... It was a really easy decision to make, and it's an easy game to pick up.
And you like the lore, and you know the place.
And it's an established IP. Like, I don't need to ask any questions. I know. That's Rivendell. Okay, cool.
I feel like we're sitting in front of, or at around a, like, bulletin board with all of these scraps of paper that have pieces of what it would take to make a good, massively multiplayer online role-playing game, and yet none of them, like, puts all of them into the same basket.
Can I throw a curveball really quick?
Sure.
I
would love to see an MMO, like truly massively multiplayer game, where combat was not the primary focus of
gameplay. Completely
agree
with
now
you.
Now, you say that, and I've heard
Galaxy's
it said before.
Tried it,
how would you do it?
Well, that's way, way more complicated because I think somebody would have branched out to try that if it weren't so risky or so tough to do.
What replaces combat?
Well,
I'd love to see a game that completely replaced it.
So imagine a... I don't know, because it's in everyone's minds now. A Walking Dead massively multiplayer game where the focus was not go out and shoot as many zombies as you can.
What class are you?
Yeah. No. It's about.
What do you do? I'm just walking around.
You know, maybe you're dropped into your server and they give you a house. And it's like, you know, there's other random people that are in other areas that start in the game and you have to.
Build your base?
I don't know.
Kind of like Fortnite.
Take Oregon Trail and just blow it out into an MMO type of thing where you're going and collecting supplies and trying to get from A to B. Yeah. And
you can like be an ox.
And you can.
I think what you're talking about is Minecraft.
Exactly. No.
That's a good point.
I think you're talking about Minecraft.
What you're talking about sort of is Minecraft.
But Minecraft doesn't have a lot of the MMO social things that.
It can.
But there is no. I don't know. I mean, I think I also would think it would be great if somebody figured out a way to leverage like the gray choice dialogue decisions into a cooperative situation where you have multiple people vying for the I guess
SWTOR
did that. But to do it in a more dynamic way so that it's everybody's responding. And depending on who's in your party, it will, you know, sort of change the dynamic of the outcome and the conversation. I don't know. I think there's other things to do other than clicking on tons of dudes and selecting something from a hot bar. That's the main reason that I haven't ever really gotten into it.
That I will agree with you. Watching cooldowns is not fun.
That's why Terra's combat system is awesome.
And I've come to that conclusion after trying to get back into Guild Wars 2 over the holiday. And that's why I was thinking about like Lord of the Rings, which uses that traditional interface with skills and a hot bar. But it's keeping you engaged through the lore, right? Because especially if you're a Tolkien fan, you're going to be really caught up in it. So it's giving you that entertainment response through your engagement with the world and playing there and being the character in the Tolkien world. And you're willing to put up with some of the, you know, interface parts.
It is really basic UI. I mean, the upside of that is I know exactly what to do. I know what, you know, the hotkeys are. You know, I know how to bring up my character screen. But, And I guess as far as cooldowns go, I'm a hunter, so I don't really have any magic classes, so I can just spam arrows. So I don't really have cooldowns.
That's nice.
Just saying. Be a hunter.
But it's the interactivity of playing the combat from Terra that I want, with the connection of place and lore of a Tolkien world like Lord of the Rings or something equivalent. World of Warcraft obviously had built enough background that people had real buy-in to that world, right? With the, you know, sophistication or zophistication of the way
something's different,
the way Guild Wars handles it, because you know you were talking earlier, Jeff, about groups and getting together with your group and everyone having a role, and it's like that experience is the piece that is a bit walling off to MMOs, because if you're not in that group, if you don't have that group that's ready to play and that group to play all the time, then you don't have the ability to have that experience.
Right.
And Guild Wars 2 just really solves that. Like, there's so many things
Guild
Wars 2 does really well in retrospect.
I completely agree.
So I was thinking back, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to hop into it, is, you know, its whole ability to let you go almost anywhere and experience things and no more tapping and letting you all participate in fights, the world monsters, the world events.
It doesn't matter what level you are.
All that stuff works so freaking well, and the game experience is so great.
It just sucks that all your abilities are lame.
They are. Why do you think they're lame?
You don't do cool stuff.
I think you do. What class did you
really
play?
Oh God! I can't even remember the names of them anymore. I played the
Charn, and there's the
class.
No, the okay.
Is it? So I'm playing
it's like the Paladin type class. The Justicar, is it called?
No, the Crusader or Guardian.
Guardian. Yeah, that's why I played Guardian.
All right, so maybe that was not as fun. I'm playing the Thief class as an assassin, and it's like it's pretty cool because my primary beginning attack is that I can steal an elemental or character-based attack from whatever I'm attacking and then use it against them.
Right.
Which is kind of cool. And then it starts off, and actually that class actually uses a whole different system than any other character in the game. But that's not the point. The point is that it's still watching cooldowns and still punching buttons. And yes, there are cool things that my character does, but I don't actually do anything other than press 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, 5, 2, 4-3-1-1-3-1.
Whereas in Terra, I'm charging up my attack. I'm playing with a controller. I'm holding down X to charge my attack. I let it go to release my attack. That chains into another attack, and I have to hit X at a certain time to chain into my next attack.
It feels like an action game.
It is an action
game. I know.
Game.
I remember playing that.
Blocking. Guys get knocked down, and when they get knocked down, certain of my attacks can proc that I can do only when they're knocked down, and I go leaping in the air and slam them.
And yet
it's an action game.
And yet you're stuck in this framework of traditional RPG land.
Exactly.
And then if I want the Tolkien experience, I have to go over to Lord of the Rings, which doesn't give me either of these other two things. It's like, why can I not have them all together?
I think what Jeff said is really the promised land. Mm-hmm. And I think DayZ kind of tickled that a little bit. And certainly Minecraft's popularity is due in large part to giving people that experience that is creative and that is communal and that is, hey, look what I made and look what I've done in this universe. And if you can do that in an MMO scale, and you can do it with great graphics, and maybe Fortnite is going to try to do something like that, but I'm shocked that there hasn't already been a bunch of copycats stealing the Minecraft-ness. And I don't mean building block worlds.
Did you ever play Lego Universe or whatever?
I didn't. But I don't think it was really like that. It was more a traditional MMO.
See, I never played it either. So.
Yeah, I saw it at several trade events.
But that was sort of the promise, was that you could like build all this stuff.
But it really wasn't that, from what I understand. And I didn't play it, so I don't have first-hand knowledge, but from what I could pick up from it. And it was also really geared for young kids.
Sure. Well, yeah. It is Lego stuff.
Yeah. I mean, well, like, it's a lot of money on Legos.
So have I. It's the Muppet thing, though. It's like something.
So you go buy the Frank Lloyd Wright house Lego sets, like $100. Like
it's
falling water.
It's made for kids, but adults can appreciate it, I guess.
Right. But I think there is a yearning for this communal, massive experience where we're all interacting with each other and we don't all have to run out and smack 12 rats. We can, there's
I'm cool with that.
And I think Daisy is like, survive, see if you can survive. And that people were so interested in that they were willing to put up with a lot of that game's,
well, I would say that Guild Wars 2 is the first baby step towards what you're talking about, because here I can play Guild Wars 2 on my own and I don't have to worry about people taking my resources because it's giving me my own set of resources. I can go out and fight stuff. If someone else is fighting stuff, I'm naturally just going to go, if I walk by and someone's like fighting something, I'm just going to go help them. Or if they're dead, I'm going to go potentially raise them because it gives me experience too. And it's like you're in the world, and there's no reason that you couldn't extend beyond that and have other things going on other than combat and just letting everybody do their thing. And I think that's a really cool idea.
I mean, Galaxy's tried that a little bit, and you could have like the hairdresser class and you're supposed to be able to make money as a dancer, et cetera, et cetera.
Really?
And, yeah, when it launched. You don't remember that?
Oh, I remember the promise. I think by the time I got into sample it,
they had changed. It had massive changes.
Yeah.
But when it started, it was like, you're going to be able to be a quest giver. You're going to be able to be...
You mean Star Wars Galaxies.
That's what I said, right?
Did I
say it
wrong? No, you did. I was thinking the wrong...
No, Swords Galaxies back in the day.
No. Yeah. When Galaxies... But it was so... There was so much minutia and so many subsystems that weren't in and of themselves fun to play with.
And it was clumsy. It was a clumsy realization of that. But I think...
Conceptually, though, it's a neat
idea. Yeah, it is a really neat idea.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's also, though, the question is, how much are people willing to accept change? So here's an interesting point that both MH Silver and KS Nova XZ brought up about Halo 4. And that is that it's fallen off for them very quickly. And as a matter of fact, MH Silver put it this way. He said, 343 Industries is learning the hard way what happens when you abandon the identity of your game and the desires of your core fan base to pursue the almighty Call of Duty audience. Now, of course, here it's a shooter. So he's talking about how Halo 4 is chased to be more Call of Duty-like in level up, in spawns around the map, in doing some of those things that changed the tactical nature of Halo combat, really changed it for the core base. But do I, as an MMO developer, how much do I need to worry about that same thing? Mm-hmm. Or are there other places for them to go? I kind of wonder, like, how much do you need to worry about it as a shooter developer? Do you need to really worry about doing Call of Duty? Because Call of Duty already does Call of Duty.
Yeah.
I don't know. So basically, to follow up on the Halo 4 thing, which is, this is actually, was quite interesting when I followed his link. He gave a link, this is in last week's show thread, to the Halo Charts site, and that's just halocharts.com. And they chart the online population in multiplayer. Now, this is a little bit different than what Major Nelson reports. So Major Nelson reports online population playing a game, which just simply means you're playing Halo 4, you're connected to the internet. This Halo Charts, though, chart goes and uses Waypoint data to look at how many people are actually playing the game. And it was pretty striking how after the initial peak of people playing the game right when it came out, it dropped off very rapidly. Hmm. And it stabilized again, but it stabilized at a much lower spot than you would have expected. Hmm. It runs like around 100,000 as opposed to like right when it hit, it was like 400,000. Hmm. And it's a really big drop off. And so their point, MH Silver and KS Nova, was that it's been dumbed down and that it's stuck now in this sort of limbo between two games where it's not fast enough to beat, you know, COD at its game, but it's no longer the pure sort of experience that that Halo was. And I wonder if the same symptoms start to play into some of these MMOs as they start to try and tinker with formulas and figure out, like, oh, what do we do?
I think in the case of MMOs, I mean, they're looking at a huge cliff to climb or a huge mountain to climb when you're building one of those things. Huge amounts of resources, typically. Yeah. A lot of time, a lot of development time. And I just don't think that... Well, taking risks in that space is sort of like, I mean, it's you've got such a huge investment in this project. I don't think it would be as it shouldn't feel as risky as it does to those developers to try something completely new. But really, those MMO makers are chasing World of Warcraft. They're like, okay, what?
Yeah, everyone, positions himself and how can we be the WoW killer?
Right, and even Blizzard doesn't know what their secret sauce is. It seems like they don't even know what it was that catapulted that to the top.
So let me wrap this up then on this. Each of you, or let's just talk about this. Like, what does a next gen MMO look like? What does a next gen MMO look like? What makes it? What's going to stand out? When are we going to say, oh, this is a next gen? Because I frankly thought it was going to be Guild Wars 2, and I feel like Guild Wars 2 took a step that direction with the way it changed the in-game functions, but the fact that it was still so much a, use your cooldown abilities and like the playing of the game still felt so much like I was playing any other MMO that it didn't achieve that escape velocity.
Well, as an avid MMO player, these are games that I enjoy and I play most of the big ones that come out. I really believe, and I've said this before on the show, but I really believe that everything after Guild Wars 2 has to account for Guild Wars 2. Like, everything that comes out now, there's certain things, as we've talked about, just ease of grouping, ease of play,
No subscription.
Well, that's a big part, right? Too. But I think that there's a before Guild Wars 2 and after Guild Wars 2. And while it's not a home run and it's not the game I'm playing right now, I really find the lack of features in all the other MMOs that Guild Wars 2 has
annoying. Yeah.
And there, I think that's a first step toward where we're headed. I don't know the answer to your question. I hope that it's more like what Jeff was talking about. I hope it's more robust and interesting a world rather than a less robust and more streamlined world. I feel like a lot of the games that have come out post WoW have been like, how can we get you into fighting and out of fighting faster? Mm-hmm. And I hope it's a more interesting, varied landscape of really going back to what I think the sort of Ultima Online fantasy of what MMOs are, which is, hey, you know these role-playing games where you encounter people in the world? What if all those were actual people?
Right.
You know, I think that's the sort of dream of what an MMO is.
Could that be Elder Scrolls Online?
No.
Oh, I'm so optimistic.
No, but to sort of, jump off what you were saying, Jeff, I think an intermediary step would be to have a game like Terra that was playable on consoles, streamlined enough so that if you're a gamer, you get your controller, you get your headset, you're in a party, boom, you're talking to them in real time on your headset, basically, I don't know, making it feel and then have the action combat so you basically feel like you're playing, Darksiders or Kingdoms of Amalur or whatever, but you're playing with other live human beings, and there are other big, huge quests and other factions and things that kind of so you basically forget, because every time you sit down to play an MMO right now, you're like, oh, I'm playing an MMO. Like, you look at it immediately, and I don't know an MMO that makes me fools me.
I would
thinking.
Say that right there, you just hit the nail on the head for me of what would make a next gen MMO is an MMO
UI?
That I sat down and played, and I didn't feel like I'm playing an MMO.
Right.
And maybe it's I've always thought that another one that is sort of pushing towards that area is Monster Hunter.
Yeah. It's so funny you bring that up because, you know, in Terra, there's these things called BAMs, which big-ass monsters, which is basically a boss fight where you don't have to go into a dungeon or an instance to get to them. They're just roaming around the world.
Dude, did you fight the Margera?
Bam Margera? Yeah. I like Bam Bam Bigelow, personally. But it's basically, I've commented numerous times while we've been playing that this is kind of Monster Hunter. This is basically Monster Hunter. They require, you know, five-man kind of, or, you know, multiple people to take them down. I want an accessible-to-me Monster Hunter. I know people are going to be like, well, you just give it a shot. But I tried on the Wii, and I did not have fun.
There'll be another one coming, but I agree. And that or Phantasy Star Online.
Yeah,
remember that?
Which was a great game back in the day.
That's the thing.
Wasn't there going to be a new one?
Well, there is on Japan. It's on PC.
Oh, it's already out.
Yeah. All right, stick around, folks. We're going to come back. Still half of this 2013 inaugural show to go. We don't know what we're going to talk about. We'll reacquaint ourselves with the show blocking plan, figure out what we're going to talk about.
Good idea.
Get back on track and do the second half of We Can Confirm when we continue.
Song about Mario Sunshine right there.
Dude, I thought I'd bring a little sun to your winter. That was one of the best tracks of 2012. I thought it was one of the best tracks of 2012.
That is your jam. That is your
jam. I got lots of jams. That was a great track for 2012. All right. Mr. Jeff Cannata has an idea.
Well, I was doing a lot of thinking about, you know, 2013 and what's coming up, and I'm going to talk about something, and you guys can tell me if you're, you know, it's only peripherally related to gaming, but I think it will have a big impact on gaming.
Let's hear it.
And it's something that I'm really drinking the Kool-Aid on.
Electricity.
Have you guys heard about this stuff?
I think it's here to stay.
Shocking.
I was flying my kite the other day.
This kite.
It is Google Glass. I think...
The glasses?
Yes. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid on this. I really think that it is a major... shift. It's going to have major repercussions for all of
it is also
culture.
It is also going to cause a major increase in people getting slammed in the crosswalk while they're
looking up in the corner of their eye.
Yeah. It needs to be AI that has cameras here that can see if a car is
coming
and alert me.
Have you seen Steve Martin's The Jerk?
This is shit.
Optigrab.
Okay, so you can make fun of it. Maybe I'm crazy and maybe I'm naive, but I think touch was the last thing that changed everything. Like the whole idea that anything can come out now and not have touch, any piece of technology, everything has, we expect to be able to reach out and touch a screen and it respond to that. And I think that it took a few years, but that has changed all of technology. And I think in the same way, wearables and always on functionality and this idea of what Google Glass is going to do, where you're constantly uploading your data and you're seeing the world in first person.
So let me ask you a question. Your Kool-Aid basically...
Well, it's first person.
Your Kool-Aid basically boils down to this. Last segment, when you're sitting there talking about Guild Wars 2, and you're like, what character...
I want to be in it.
What character am I playing? You know, I was playing that character. What's that class? You would have had your glass... You would have been sitting here with your glasses on naturally anyway, and you just would have, like, hit a button or done something, and it would have, like, pulled up...
Virtual reality.
I get that. You just want the first augmented reality MMO. Like you.
Well, here's what I think.
Game.
You know, like, let me. Are you guys? Do you guys think I'm crazy that
I don't? Maybe I watch too much Tech War. or read too much Dick Warren.
Yeah. Well, it's fucking, you know what it is? It's fucking, the great, great book that everybody read and I liked too. Ready Player One.
That was going to be my finishing move.
Haha, stole it.
Jerk.
Am I the only one here that read that? Did you read it?
I just finished it, yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's not great, but it's good.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's good. Very good. But the ideas in it are really great.
I liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought the love story is a little cheesy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, the ideas are awesome. And it posits a world where, you know, there is one MMO to rule them all, and it in which all other things exist. Like, there's a virtual world you can go into, and there's planets in that virtual world, and there's a planet for every conceivable IP that has ever been. Somebody modeled every... You want to go to the Death Star, you can go to the Death Star. You want to go to Lord of the Rings, you can go to Lord of the Rings. You want to go to, you know, Discworld, you can go to Discworld. Everything that has ever been is modeled.
Want to go to a Rush album, you can go to a Rush album.
Exactly.
So it's like the Matrix meets Disneyland.
Right. And how you experience that is with,
yes,
you know,
yes,
VR goggles, haptic gloves.
And a positive attitude.
Garnet is looking at me like, why did I let you bring up this topic?
No, I mean,
I think it's going to change.
And an electric codpiece.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, but
that's
if
the most important part.
If you've read about Google Glasses, they are. They are going to add.
And everybody that's used them are talking about how cool they are and how much it's additive. And I don't think it's
a step in the Matrix direction.
It's not VR.
But
I understand that.
I think there's going to be a UI that appears up right here, and I can scan you, and I can buy your sweater from my Google Glasses, and I think I can see a meal, and I can find out what's in it, and I think that that's a step that Google Glass is going to take.
But don't you want a gaming console that leverages that technology?
Yes, and I think that it's possible that the next generation will
leverages.
I don't think next generation, but
leverages it how?
Well, that's the topic that I wanted to bring up. You're not excited about this.
I am cautiously skeptical because I saw the Google Glasses video that everybody saw and was like, you know what? That's really cool. I would totally do that. I totally want that.
Me
That's
too.
Awesome. And then I don't know. I mean, I thought about where we are with the state of miniaturization, where we are with the amount of connectivity and processing it would take to. It's like I could see something like that working in a couple of years as a slave to a phone of some sort. You know, some sort of.
Right, well, set aside
you
your real
somewhere.
your
set aside
slavish,
the fact that it's completely impossible.
You're slave to realism here. I'm talking about, does that kind of thing get you excited about the possibility of what's right around the corner? Because to me, I really think wearable technology, I think it's always on connected wearable technology. It's undoubtedly where we're going, but I think it can change how we interact with gaming as well.
I get excited about it, and I get excited about the potential for things like that. And I think that especially in that realm, there's going to be a definite learning, crawling, falling period before we start to get it to where it's like something that's really great. And I'll probably have some of the first ones, just like I had a G1 Android phone, and that thing was kind of a walking,
right,
crawling, waddling mess. And now Android phones have like come into their own. And I think this will be that on a much grander scale. I mean, the first time we start trying to figure out how to actually really make something that is like a pair of glasses you wear around with you all the time.
But let me just posit this.
Okay.
Okay. You have your home console.
Okay.
All right.
A peripheral to that home console is a Google Glasses type of a situation.
Okay.
Okay.
So you put...
You mean like my 3D glasses for my 3D television that I never watch in 3D?
Okay. God, negative Nancy over here. Just let me freaking roll this out, this vision of this fantastical future world that I want to create.
Okay. I have my console. I have my glasses.
Right. So you put
you're
on your...
James Bond villain.
Whatever heads-up display you've got in your game isn't displayed on your television. It's displayed on your glasses that are reacting
so
in real time.
Move the Wii pad to your glasses.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So I don't have to look fucking down.
Right.
So but there's more to it than that, right?
Compass up here in the upper right hand corner of my vision. I got, and basically you just move all the UI into your eyeballs.
Right.
Right.
That's cool,
you
right?
You have voice activated menus.
That is cool. I just don't know how much it actually changes the landscape of gaming, like from a gameplay perspective. It is a neat piece of tech that I would like to have, but, you know.
far cooler would be that it would be a way to implement good head tracking.
Right.
And I think that that would solve a tremendous barrier of entry, because I think one of the things, like, when we talk about controlling games and people getting not accustomed to the sticks, the thing from having watched a number of casual people play games, movement inside...
Casual people. Like, it's funny. Concept. This is people just, like, lounging around.
Casual people.
Got a brandy snifter in one hand, a cigar in the other, and hand him a controller. I have to put down something. What am I going to put down? I'll put down the cigar. Yeah. Anyway,
you those capri have to pants with Google glasses.
Nice casual
and flip flops.
Sorry, it's most often not the movement. Like, it's easy for them to understand moving the character around inside the space. It's the looking around inside 3D space that really throws
it's
people
the camera
off.
Joystick.
It's the camera thing. The camera joystick always throws people who haven't played a lot of games off. If you could turn that into a simple like head
tracking
system.
The problem is, if you turn your head,
then you're not looking at it.
You're not looking at the television anymore.
You basically have to have your head, which is rotatable, inside a bank of monitors that completely circles your head.
Cylinder.
Yes, I'll buy one. What do I give you money?
Like a crescent,
take my money.
Watch for the Kickstarter. No, I don't know. I mean,
a crescent TV with a couch that moves.
So inside your virtual
Star Tours.
That I could get behind.
As long as my glasses are there, I can project things onto those glasses. So if I turn, maybe where I'm looking ahead is one thing, but as I turn my head, I can see at least like wireframes or something off in the side, right? Or I could project 3D into my screen, you know. So
well,
like,
that's, I mean,
I
that's
can virtualize
just sort of like
outside.
VR goggles, which is not what I'm thinking. And it's not what Google goggles are. They are sort of supplemental information to the world around you as you're perceiving it. And it's constantly recording the world around you and uploading that data to the cloud.
I guess from the game perspective, the thing that I have is what Jeff said made a lot of sense. Like, just moving that information off of the television screen, yeah, it's really, really cool. I think that would be really cool and immersive, but I don't know how it is a game changer, because I can display all those things up on the screen, or I can display them on the little screen in front of my eyes. And
unless you're doing AR gaming or taking it out into the real world somehow, like, you know, in the next CSI game, go to the library in your town and find the clue that is virtual.
Oh, that's kind of rad.
You know what I mean? Like, you could do cool stuff like that. But yeah, like regular gaming in front of your TV, I don't know.
I don't know. I think there's something there, and I think it's going to happen, and I think all of you guys are going to owe me an apology.
I agree with you.
Dude, I will not only owe you an apology, I will buy you a drink and sit down in front of your crazy contraption and put on the glasses and glaze out just like waiting for Wesley Crusher to come save us all.
Guys, I'm telling you. You agree with me.
I agree with you.
Keep talking about how you agree with me, Nicole.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. And let me just say,
I like that point.
What a great idea you had.
Ah.
So glad you brought it up.
Those are both very good points.
No, but I mean, I think that Google Glasses are a step in a direction where that we're going to have UIs in our glasses, and we're going to have virtual reality almost. And I think that's where gaming's going to go next.
So I'm going to be at CES next week.
Yeah.
Interestingly
enough.
Bringing
us presents.
And the funny thing is like, it's not such a gaming thing. Like, the gaming side of it has really dwindled quite incredibly, despite the fact that
it's
CES
backroom demos that no one gets to see but like seven dudes.
Even that, there's not really that much of that anymore.
Yeah, not really.
There's so little
you
going on
invited.
In gaming. But
I'm just kidding. I wasn't either.
But there is tons of gear and stuff.
Okay, I tell you, without having seen everything yet, because there's going to be a lot of cool stuff I don't know about yet, but going in, one of the coolest things I've seen so far is the LG is going to debut, I think it's LG, is debuting a projector that'll do a 100-inch screen on a wall only 22 inches away. You can set it only 22 inches away. That's pretty rad.
You hit exactly where I was going to go, which is, I think that realistically what we can look forward to is another really big jump in screen sizes. I mean, think about it. It wasn't that long ago that at home I was sitting in front of a 20-something inch 4x3 CRT
right.
television. And I mean, by not that long ago, I mean like, what, 8 or 9 years ago?
Probably not even that long.
Let me see.
Maybe.
I got a plasma. So I got a plasma in like the second generation of Panasonics. It was a 720p, and I'm going to guess that was about 06 so that's like 7 years ago,
and that's still
now.
Within the lifetime of this console generation,
right? Like,
yeah, that's crazy.
That is crazy.
So here's my question
so
to you,
think about what
do they have to be thinking about 4K TVs
now? Oh, absolutely.
You think that you
because
think
I think that's one of the cool things to see
answer.
That's one of the really cool things to see.
I think any console that comes out, if they're hoping to have an 8 or 9 or 10 year life cycle, they better fucking be thinking
like
that.
Like, you want glasses. You know what I actually really want? Now we're just gonna open and show the true crackpot nature of the hosts. I want the fucking video wall. I want to be able to walk into my den
Back
and
to
sit
the future
down.
Too.
And
Mick Fry, you're fired.
That's what I want, and then I can.
Tough
I want
for
to be able
apartment
to play games
living.
On that. And you know what? At the same time, have other screens on the side of it. Have like the main part of my screen. Have my game I'm playing, and over here maybe I'm looking at my recipe for dinner. And over here I got the weather report, and you know, yeah. That's what I want.
The weather report comes in smaller. I mean, you don't need a whole wall for the weather,
right?
It's sunny.
Still sunny.
I mean, and I think that we're still a ways off from that. I think, though, that we are increasingly seeing, like, you know, look, screen size is jumping all the time, and thinness is, like, the big deal. Like, so we're getting closer and closer to having, like, these super thin panels that get really, really big.
Well, since we're doing... this episode has turned into crazy 2013. Why not?
This
we're
is
in
what
the
you
future,
guys
motherfuckers! Flying cars, bitch!
No, as long as you got the glasses, you want the Mattel glove for your...
yeah. No, so let me ask you this. If you had video wall, I'll open this up to the group.
When
if you had video wall, tomorrow morning when you get your video wall,
I would only watch it while wearing my jetpack.
That's dangerous. Anyways,
coupled with Kinect
not to
sensor.
Be used indoors. Do you want games where what it's larger than 1-to-1? So that what you're looking at is giant hands holding giant gun on your wall.
Yes, keep
or do you
talking.
Want that like
good.
Sized down so that it's
wait till you see the porn.
Oh, Jesus. God. No. Garnet Lee, bringing it home. No, but seriously, like
this image brought to you by.
If you're, do you want a game that will size appropriate to the screen it's displayed on?
I want the option.
Why not?
Zoom in,
you
zoom
want-
out.
Why would you not? So you want
that's
a
the
giant,
biggest damn Hobbit I've ever seen.
You want a 100-foot screen, and you wanted like a movie where it's bigger than you, or do you want it like sized appropriately where it could you could be standing in the field?
Oh no okay no I don't want it bigger than life. I want it like
giant like if you're in a first person shooter and you
that.
See big ass hands.
No, I don't want that.
Holding a big ass gun.
No, I don't want that. I want more. I
you
want more
1-to-1.
Shit. I want a bigger, broader, expansive view.
Right. So it looks like you're looking out a window.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
And
I
you see a person the size of you as your avatar walking around.
If it's a third
well, we're on the
person,
same page. Let's make it happen, scientists.
All right.
Get on that.
Yep. I do think, though, that we are closer to getting large-scale screens and how that'll change. I mean, look, it's going to be 4K television is actually going to happen relatively quickly because the manufacturers have tried a number of ways to keep people buying televisions and it hadn't worked.
Well, it's kind of worked.
Smart televisions worked a little bit.
Yeah.
3D didn't work so much. Mm. And maybe we'll get to 3D. Maybe we'll get to holograms.
Oh, well, now we're talking.
No.
You know, I was looking at receivers. I was going to buy a new receiver this Christmas season. And then I realized I'm unemployed. But I was looking at receivers and all of them are like 4K ready. And I'm like, oh, is that where is that what's happening now?
I guess.
Yes.
I don't know if mine's 4K ready. I just got later. I really like mine. It wasn't terribly expensive.
I was looking at Onkyos.
Onkyos are
the
nice.
818.
Onkyos are really nice.
Yeah.
I wound up not getting an Onkyo, but...
Anyway. What did you get? Pioneer?
I bought a Sony.
Sony.
Because I have all the other Sony stuff, so it...
Cross-media bar, bitch.
But actually, when I was reading about it, the reason I bought the Sony was that though it was knocked a little bit for its UI, it was supposed to have the best audio internal for a sub-$500 AV receiver.
Do you guys get those Wicked employee store discounts from Sony? Since Ariel works
the Wicked
for them.
Ones.
Oh,
actually,
the Sony store, because if you're not buying your electronics through there, you fucking should be.
Yeah, they do have crazy deals.
I mean, like ridiculous.
You get a decent deal.
Yeah. Depends on what it is.
Regardless of all of that.
Yeah.
How do we? Well, we were off on
the
2013.
Future. We were in
the
future.
Crazy predictions. Yeah, I don't like.
In the year 2000.
You started with the glasses.
It was like.
By the way, remember the movie Strange Days?
Yeah. Oh, I know, dude.
Here we go.
I like that movie.
That was set in like, wasn't that set in like 1999?
Yeah. Something like that.
Something ridiculous like that.
I know. But that was awesome. That was all about like video, full VR video games and like people recording their memories and shit. But that's what Google Goggle, you can like literally record all of your life.
That's so not appropriate.
Well, someone just revealed what kind of life he leads.
Someone maybe did.
I don't know. So the other thing, though, is that I still I've fought the whole notion of controllers being bad for a long time because I still think that there's something to be said for when I'm playing a game, I'm playing a game. And if the closer I get to making motions and reactions and interactions one-to-one, the more it becomes like doing the thing and I'm just going to go do the thing. But there are a lot of things I can do in games that I can't do in the real world.
Right.
So
push X to be awesome.
Yeah. And I like push X. I like push X to be awesome. And I want to have that fantasy and that fictional experience because that is my fiction that I like. You know, that my primary fiction that I enjoy is video games. And that's always been my stance on that stuff. So and the controller is a pretty good interface for that. Are there opportunities to improve on it? Probably. There are probably ways we could do better controllers, but I'm not necessarily sure that motion or further extending motion or
the very, 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 very unprofessional.
I thought there was like a truck crashing into us. It's brakes on.
I thought we were having a Fringe event.
All right, guys. That was the guitar solo from Purple Rain.
Yeah. Anyway.
That was the co-host formerly known as Jeff.
So now we've been sidetracked on that. I don't know.
I'm sorry. You know what? I totally derailed everything. And there's going to be all this talk back this week of like,
no, I think it's
talking about games.
What do you think? So, since we are actually talking about like next gen stuff, what do you really think about next gen? We talked a whole ton in the second show from the New Year's break, so the one that was just on, about the new consoles and about how we thought it'd be service driven. One of the commenters, Mononoke Teapot, said that or asked us how we think that the regionalization of those services will affect the adoption of those consoles across the globe. So will it be a further fragmentation? So like right now we think of North America, clearly, you know, the Xbox fortress, and then Europe we think of as sort of split, but PS3 really holds sway there. And then of course Japan completely
Sony, cell phones.
Sony and Nintendo. So, for instance, he cited, you know, Hulu isn't in the UK, but BBC iPlayer isn't in the States. That sort of fragmentation, will that continue to pull things apart? Or, you know, is there some way that maybe it starts to pull things together and entertainment starts to be less regionalized? Or how much do those services even play into the game player of the next generation?
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say that often when services aren't in the UK or in parts of Europe, it's because they can't get the rights.
Right.
Or because it's a financial thing where they have to pay more or they don't get as much return. And so I don't think it's so much a choice, like we're depriving this audience. So if it's a financial thing and they have to pay again for the rights, then I think that these people are just going to have to find other ways of getting things, and it's gonna cause a divide, and it has been, and that's why region locked 3DSs are a bummer, and it's a bummer. That's my point. That's my opinion.
Did you see also on that note of region locked 3DS? Did you see that the Wii U pad is region locked?
Oh, what? Interesting. I did not.
It just seems so limiting.
The controller is region locked.
I don't know.
Jeff, you were going
to
say?
I just tend to think that sort of stuff has more impact on the publisher and the hardware manufacturer and stuff and whoever's making those deals than it does on the end consumer because they, you know what services you have available to you in your area, and you're not going to be upset if you don't get access to whatever the British equivalent of Netflix is.
But not having Hulu is a big deal.
It's called a boot.
A boot.
It's
called Netflix. That's what it's called.
I think they have Netflix. But I mean, there are a lot of games in Japan that come out there that we may never get. And that seems silly, especially with the internet, where I can watch someone streaming it and playing it, and I know they have it, but I can't bring it to me. Like, why?
Well, because it's
and unless what you, have
and,
I done?
And unless you can read Japanese, it's, you know, there's other hurdles Chota. There too. Okay, well, then you're all set.
To Teapot's question, I think the reality is that if you like that. To Teapot's question, I think the reality is that these devices, if they have, well, because they will have great aspirations to being your box in the living room, will have to be flexible to deliver whatever are the predominant popular services in whatever region you live in. And maybe that'll ultimately lead to some breaking down of the walls and some studios or rights holders thinking of how to make money globally. But regardless of that, Yeah, BBC iPlayer, it's still going to be available on popular devices. And the way those folks all look at it is they want to be on as many outlets inside a region as possible. So if you're a BBC iPlayer, if you're Hulu, you want to be like whatever screen someone's carrying in the region that you're available, you want to make sure you can get on that screen, mm-hmm. whether it's a phone or a tablet or a refrigerator. Of the future.
Or Google Goggles.
Or Google Goggles. I should have said
that. I just want them to make it so I can say that all day.
Google Goggles.
Google Goggles.
And thanks to Mononoke T-Bot, who listens to us also in the UK. He says Saturday mornings are his listening time, as it's too late to catch Friday in the UK. It's just the little differences. Over there, it's called the Weekend Royale with cheese.
Like, I get it.
I had to get that in there.
Nice.
It's always good to have that little reference in there. What else do I know? Let's see. Oh, you know, this was another interesting comment, because this came up and I thought it was interesting because I've been playing Dishonored, and I had time to really play Dishonored leisurely. Has everybody played Dishonored?
I have not.
Yes, that was actually one of my big focuses or foci for the holiday break.
Yeah, I saw you had, and Jeff, you played Dishonored.
Oh, yeah.
Did you finish it?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really, like, I'm super, super, super loving Dishonored. Like, I really like...
Low chaos or high chaos, Garnet? Are you playing?
I'm playing low chaos.
Are you?
And chaos is really related to how many people you kill in this game.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to... Oh, God, I'm going to open a kettle of worms here. Spec Ops has been back in
a
the
kettle?
News again.
I think it's a can of
worms.
Worms or a kettle of fish.
You know, you wake up in a new room every day. it's a kettle of fish and a can of worms.
I've never heard kettle of fish.
Hey, you guys want these worms here? I got them in a kettle.
So we'll put Jesus it next Christ. To the barrel of monkeys and the fucking whatever that
it's
is.
It's a barrel of fish and monkeys.
It's like shooting
anyways,
with
in
worms.
A pond.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
Spec Ops has been garnering a ton of attention, and there were a lot of folks who over the break were upset with us because Spec Ops came, or specifically with me, because Spec Ops came up again, and if they haven't gone back and listened to the episode after we had Corey on, who was the designer of the game, I was not feeling all of the... I don't feel that it lived up to its aspirations, because at the end of the day, it still was very much a shooter. And you can make the argument, I think the argument that's made is that it turned that equation some, because in this case, mowing down all of those soldiers was supposed to give you a feeling different than mowing down all those soldiers in Call of Duty or any other game. And I think that potentially because I played so many shooters that was greatly lost on me, because it still felt so much like any other shooter.
No, I had kind of the same reaction to it, actually.
But I think that it also was... I think it also was indicative of... Yes, it aspired to do that, but those Heart of the Darkness stories and Apocalypse Now didn't have that body count. And you can't, I don't think, really put into a real equation of like pulling out emotions that sort of body count. It's just too far-fetched, right? It takes things too far. Now, you asked me about low high. The reason I'm leaning up to this is that Dishonored has, I think, just the right number of enemies throughout the levels to really make you make choices. So you can, the funny thing about Dishonored is it's like the drug dealer with the crack pipe as far as violence. Like, it urges you to go violent. It's like, here are all these toys to play with, Corvo. Here's all these things all you can use to kill people. You've got these cool traps you can put down, and when the people come near them, they'll come up and like do all these whirly blades and slice them pieces. You've got crossbow bolts. You've got exploding crossbow bolts. You've got
rats.
A pistol. You've
rats,
got you can turn
rats,
into rats.
Rats
you can
rats,
clean
rats.
Their bones. All these things to kill people, and yet you've got enough weapons in your armory there to go through a Call of Duty level. But you don't face a Call of Duty level of opposition. You face a thief level of opposition. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of that, it really makes a difference, right? And so now I have to choose to play stealth. But I choose to play stealth, and I really like it, even though I don't usually like stealth games.
Player agency, unlike most other games, dramatically changes that experience. Like, night and day for me. Like, so the first time I played it, I was kind of playing it like a regular thing, and I was stabbing a guy here and sneaking there. And then when I this last playthrough, I started over. I am almost to the, I think I'm on the last level, actually. I haven't killed a single person
That's awesome.
In the entire game. Like, even my targets, I've figured out other ways to dispatch them and stuff. And it is...
Talking it out really helps.
Yeah, you know, we have a little heart-to-heart.
Talk about, you know, my dad didn't appreciate me either kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Right. We talk it out and hug it out and... But
push
no,
X
but,
to empathize. Yeah.
No, but I mean, there are actual machinations in the game where you can do other, you know, alternate objectives to have a nonviolent outcome with all your targets.
Yep.
Which is also awesome. But it's one of those games that you don't see how layered and how deep it is until you go, you know what? I'm not going to stab every person I see in this section. And then you're like, oh, wait, there is other stuff to find. There is this character does have something to say to me. This, you know, there are other things I can find out and places to explore. I mean, it does that very, very well. You can play with your style truly in that game.
And you know what's another funny thing is I think by virtue of having to make those decisions individually is I've sort of really come into the character mm-hmm. to the extent that the other night I was playing and I'm now in the like seventh or eighth. So I'm getting closer to the end of the game. And just because I've been playing it and on this quest for a while, my patience playing the game has worn a little bit, and I can almost imagine Corvo's patience, like having to deal with this whole thing, having worn a little bit. And I was in a situation where I had been stealthy and been great up to this one point, and then right before I was going to knock this guy out, he turned on me, and I was just like, you know what? Screw it. Stopped time, pulled my pistol, and shot him. And then afterwards, I was like, shit, I don't...
That didn't feel right.
Yeah, I was like, But then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go on. It was really weird, like combination of feelings that it put me through from like, shit, screw it, that wasn't right, I'm going on.
Yeah. Well, that is the sweet spot for this game, which is trying to play a certain way, and then when shit goes sideways, you kind of adjust and then get back to your play style. You know, I'm the type of gamer, they're going back to like the original Thief and all that sort of stuff, that I'm trained to play first-person stealth games in a way where I'm like, okay, look at an area, it's a puzzle, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and if I screw up on any one of those steps, I'm reloading until right. Because I know what I want to do. Right. It's not a matter of figuring out, like, oh, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. It was, I just couldn't execute it properly.
And here, I'm reloading sometimes, right. but not all the times,
right.
which is weird.
It's cool.
I think, and I like the pacing of it. Anyway, I want to follow up on this, but I'll take a little break because we're at a good time to stop, and I'm going to come back on the other side and add into this comments from RV Anquetel, I don't know, Revan Santel, about our disgust with fail states, because I think that's one of the things that Dishonored does well, but he takes the opposite thing and says Dishonored is not good because it's too easy on fail states. So we'll talk about that when we come back to wrap up this first weekend confirmed of 2013. Very dramatic lead into the final segment, huh?
That was like horror movie credit music.
2013.
It's all over. So, Rivensall said that, I guess I just don't understand you guys' hate of fail states. To me, there has to be the fear of failure for there to be success, and that applies to every genre. Yet, for some reason, it's okay in XCOM, but not in a stealth game. So he goes on to talk about Dishonored and says, basically, in Dishonored, you're too badass because of the teleport move, and that teleport plus stealth together doesn't work. And I would, like, this really struck me because I have just been sitting here playing this game and adoring how, like, the thing that... Dishonored does a lot of things really well, to my mind. It does a great job in level design of marrying the level design to the abilities that it gives you to play, so that you have lots of options and they're all there in front of you. And it's like really myriad laid out. It's not,
yep.
it's a 0.5, I won't say a full, but like a 0.5 generation beyond where like Human Revolution Deus Ex was. You know, where Deus Ex, you could tell like, oh, I'm going the high route, or I'm going the mid route, or the other route. Here you kind of know occasionally, but other times you oftentimes feel like you're ad-libbing. You really feel like, oh, I'm going over here, I'm doing this, or I'm going to go over here and hide, and that's really cool. But to go in concert with that, they hit on one really cool mechanic that you use throughout the game, which is this ability to like stealth teleport a short distance. And it is so cool because it allows you to set up incredibly cool takedowns and get around and through places in ways that you simply, that other games would have used time stops or distractions. It just sort of takes that out. It's like, oh, I can just go.
Well, they can build the levels with a level of verticality that other games can't because you have that ability. Like, you're like, oh, I'm rooftop hopping now or whatever. It's really cool.
And I love the successes that I get from playing that. So I'm kind of torn here because I understand the idea of if there's no black, there's no white, right? At the same time, I struggle to try and explain my dislike for fail states beyond seeing game over is not fun, and I'm playing games for fiction and for fun. And while I want a challenge, I want the challenge to not put me to the point where I feel like I've had time wasted.
And to be fair, that fail state is actually, it's in Dishonored if you play it as a, I'm going to go through the whole level, I'm not going to be detected, and I'm not going to kill anyone. And you can self-impose that on, basically put that on yourself and go, look, every time I'm detected or whatever, I'm going to reload the game. And that is basically the fail state for the people who are really like, I need a perfect playthrough, I need to get through this. But to let things sort of unfold and, kind of go dynamically the way that they do when you screw up, is the game handles it very, very well.
And there's sort of like different types of fail states. Like, you brought up XCOM, and I'm playing XCOM on Iron Man. And so I'm sure that's where that dichotomy comes from. It's like, well, how can you play XCOM on Iron Man but not like a fail state in Dishonored? Well, if I lose somebody in XCOM, the game doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. It changes the game circumstances.
Right.
And I keep
playing. That's the key.
I keep playing around those.
I think sometimes people maybe misunderstand what we mean. It's not that I don't want any penalty for anything. I'm not saying please don't penalize me at all ever. It's saying have the game be dynamic enough to deal with my missteps in a creative way rather than game over.
Okay, you just put it way better than I did.
Or whatever.
You just put it way better than I do. Thanks.
Well then what do you want? Like, what if you run out of HP or health, whatever the equivalent is, what happens to you?
I think the most exciting games figure out ways to deal with that isn't game over. I think game over is a vestige of an antiquated modality of gaming where
put another quarter in.
Exactly.
Mark Cerny's talked about that a couple of times. He talked about it once at DICE that I watched.
Yeah, and so we've progressed beyond that. Why should I ever see those two words in a game ever?
You just wanted to respawn at your last checkpoint? Like, is that
No. Well, I mean, every game's going to be different, but I think in my ideal world, and people who listen to the show know that I brought up Heavy Rain quite a lot in reference to this, because Heavy Rain deals with things in a really interesting way. It's that your narrative changes. You let someone die in Heavy Rain, that person dies, and then things go on. Somebody didn't get out of the building before it burned down. How it happened. Yep. That's how it happened for you that time. And I think...
What about Prince of Persia? No, that's not how it happened.
Well, that's interesting, too. I mean, I think that's more along the lines of what people dislike. And Bioshock also is more along the lines of what people dislike, where it's just like, there's no penalty. And it's you didn't. Keep trying.
I would also say that there are no absolutes. Right.
Agreed.
Like there are games, when I'm playing like a retro, shooter or coin-op, like throwback or whatever, I want those fail states in there.
Oh.
Like, I want to know, like, I mean, that's part of the thing, and it's like, how far can I get before I die, and boom, that's my high score.
FTL.
Totally.
You're going to die. Like, I've almost resigned myself, having played like 5 games of FTL, that I'm not going to be ever very good at it, because I'm going to die, but I do enjoy, like, the lead up to when I die, and I can almost tell when the chaos hits, and I'm like,
oh. You mean life?
Well, and roguelikes are like that, though.
That's the expectation of the game.
They're sort of the evolution of the coin-op game over thing, while still including fail states. Like, you can have a permanent fail state and boom, you're starting the game over, but it's usually a lot more intricate and more robust, and you're really getting...
Super Meat Boy.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is
And fail states in that are totally acceptable, because the fail state is, boom, you're dead, now you're back running. Boom, you're dead, now you're back running. You know, it's like, it's so quick that it's not really, there's no penalty
there. Skyrim or Mass Effect, you die and then you have a load screen for 4 minutes.
Right. Like, that would be, there might be a better way to to handle death in a game like that. I don't necessarily think that in a big RPG having a fail state where you have hundreds of hours of gameplay and oops, I went to the wrong cave and I died, shouldn't go in there yet. I don't necessarily think reloading your game is a bad thing there, but that's just my personal.
It's hard in a game where you have a hit point system too, because like you're right, there does have to be a threat of you losing your hit points and right. and dying
and progress.
And I'm not sure yeah. that. I mean, remember Prey and its whole like escape from the spirit world thing? That was right. kind of that was it a was cool, very cool. It was a cool way of handling it. At the same time, it really was just escaping you from the idea of running out of hit points and dying. So
yeah,
you know, did it suffer because it didn't have that? I actually thought it was more fun. And you know, you said people don't like Prince of Persia, and you're right, it's controversial. I actually really liked Prince of Persia for the freedom it gave me to just go and push the limit of everything. Like, I never felt like...
I really liked that game, too. I thought it was awesome.
I also did, too.
But I know that there's a lot of backlash against
it. There is backlash.
Now are you talking about the remake Prince of Persia?
Or the third? Sands of Time. I never did the remake.
I thought you were talking about... I was talking about the subtitle-less one that with the chick that would grab you when you fell.
Okay.
I thought that's
you
what
guys, I think you guys are talking about different games then.
I'm talking about the movie. I love that movie.
but see,
I'm just kidding.
But what you guys were saying, but both hold true for both games, which is that yeah. it wasn't about, you know, oh, crap, I died. Now I have to complete this entire, you know, 20-minute puzzle over again. It was... okay, this is how this works, and it's an action-based, it's a muscle memory sort of, okay, I run here, jump, and then yeah. do, and you're basically navigating an obstacle course.
Right.
Which, with the rewind mechanic, is pretty clever, right?
Exactly.
It's not, you know, yeah. there's nothing wrong with that.
Like, there's no need to punish me for misstepping. You know, there's a way to do that and say, well... what you want to do is try this again, so try it again right now.
Right.
You know, instead of...
Yeah, instead of
you
like,
know, instead of, like, fucking dealing with the bullshit of going back to a checkpoint or whatever.
Right, right. But
talking about fail states, I think it's a perfect opportunity for you to segue into Hundreds. Because I want you to hip people to that, because you hipped me to
okay.
it.
And that is... Yeah, you're right. That is a...
Hip the people to the Hundreds.
Yeah. A fail state. So this is a new iOS game. It's actually started out... there's a free Flash version. But it's by the iOS version by Semi-Secret Software, which is the Cannibal guys. And it is a puzzle game where it's very, very minimalist art style. Like, when you look at it, look at the screenshots, you probably be like, what is this? And you play it, and ostensibly, at the very, very basic level, you have a tiny dot that's valued at zero in the middle of the screen. And when you press that dot, it counts up to 100, and then when you get to 100... you're on to the next level.
And it grows larger as it counts up.
Yes, right. The sphere grows larger. And then they put you in a level with two of these spheres. Now you have to grow them to a value of 100, but you can't be growing them when they collide, or you have to start over.
So if they, like a Venn diagram, if the two circles intersect at any point, game over.
Right.
So you have to figure out how to reach a cumulative value of 100 between all the spheres on the screen at any given time,
right,
without any of them intersecting.
That is a much more articulate way to put it. But the twist of it is there's like 100 levels, and they keep throwing, like, I'm only 20 levels into the game, and I've already been like, wow, that's pretty smart. That's really great.
Did you play
it's
Ellis?
Brilliant.
Did I play him?
Ellis?
Ellis
was out early in the iPhone lifetime, so it looks very... Yeah. It has a similar aesthetic to this. I just pulled this up in the App Store, which, by the way, the search is still so broken. I searched for Hundreds, and it's like the fourth entry.
Yeah.
How can the game named Hundreds be the fourth entry?
But it's cool. You're basically just trying to...
It's interesting.
...get to a value of 100 in however many dots are on the screen by growing them, but
and
it starts doing
intersect.
Crazy
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
like moving them around, forcing you to push two of them at the same time to grow any of the...
Yeah, because like, some dots are attached, and like they're attached via tether, and they're constantly moving around the screen, and you're doing stuff like...
You fail once, start over completely?
No. Just from that particular
stage.
It's kind of like Where's My Water or Cut the Rope or anything where... Each one is a puzzle in the sense that there are myriad ways to solve them,
right.
But you're trying to beat the clock, and if you fail it, it'll just start you over at that puzzle, and you have to do it again.
Right.
But really addictive and really clever and simple,
yeah.
But brilliant.
And some of the best multi-touch gameplay that I've seen in a while. I mean, there's good examples.
Actually, I'll have to show you Ellis. Ellis is very interesting. It's not exactly the same. It has a similar sort of aesthetic to it, but in Ellis, the idea was that there were different colored circles, mm-hmm. and there were open, so it'd be like an open circle, and then you would get blobs of a color that matched to that open circle, and you had to split the blobs into an appropriate size drop to fill up that circle, and when this filled up the circle would burst, and it would like give you like little dots, and the dots would fill up your power bar, and you couldn't let two circles of different colors touch.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. That does sound kind of similar. This is more of a, like, they layer the shit out of the mechanics in this.
Yeah, that's what's so special about it.
So you're like, 5-10 levels in, you're like, oh, this is all right. And then level 15, you're like, wow, this, okay. And then you hit one that you're stuck on, and you're like, wow, this is really fucking tricky. Like, I need some reflexes and some actually think about where these dots are going and what I'm going to press when and how this.
But, Jeff, it's $3.
It is, and I wouldn't recommend it.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, no. I don't know. It's worth the $3.
I don't know how it was ever a Flash game. Like, it seems so built for touch.
This is a much more robust version. So, like, if you basically you can get an idea of what Hundreds is by going playing the free Flash version, but this is actually much better, fully more realized experience.
It seems made for multi-touch. It's like,
yeah.
It's all about tapping your fingers all over the place. It's cool. Yeah, I dig it.
All right, I have two more fun subjects for you guys to talk about. Where was the first one? Ah, here it is. So this is on the subject of player choice, which was a subject we talked about both in relationship to The Walking Dead and Mass Effect 3. DevSword broke it down in an interesting way. It says, the reason Mass Effect 3 fails where The Walking Dead succeeds is that Mass Effect is asking the player to project a personality onto their avatar, whereas The Walking Dead is asking the player to change what happens by changing what an existing character does. So it's like giving the player the opportunity to participate in a person's life Groundhog Day style. That's a pretty good assessment of it, actually. That's an interesting,
I guess, but you could also say that you are developing a personality for your avatar in Walking Dead based on the choices you make moment to moment rather than deciding what kind of moral stance you want to take and living that choice to choice in Mass Effect.
Right, the choices in Walking Dead aren't black and white, whereas Mass Effect, it's literally Renegade, Paragon, Red or Blue. So, I mean, in that regard,
also not black and white.
Right.
Well, yeah, sure, thank you.
Technically speaking.
No, he's absolutely right. No, but I think that in Mass Effect, you're very limited into what your player choice was, and in the end, your player choice didn't matter a whole lot. But in The Walking Dead, your choices matter every, like, 3 seconds.
Because I feel like I definitely projected my personality in Walking Dead based on the fact that I did the thing that I would do in that situation as often as I could.
In Mass Effect, I was waiting for them to show me what my good action would be.
Right.
Like
I wanted the most points.
It was more like, oh, what's Shepard going to do when I do the good thing here? Oh, this is obviously, whereas in Walking Dead, you're like, okay, there's no good thing. I just have to decide.
I don't think you're disagreeing with DevSword. I think you're actually making the same point, which is that you may have interjected your personality, but it was to the extent of influencing what your player did. In each case, you're influencing what the player does, but in the case, because of the time element in Mass Effect 3, you are spending much more time probably laboring over questions and thinking about which character am I and what am I going to do and what are the implications.
Really. No,
I think it matters less. I think that
which one matters less?
Mass Effect. I think what you choose matters less. I think it's a much more maybe not linear game, but I think what you choose, no matter what you choose, certain events have to happen. And in The Walking Dead, I mean, just through episode one, people die. You choose who dies. And like, to an extent, you can choose that in Mass Effect, but not really.
Well, I mean, same way you can, almost exactly the same way in Mass Effect. In the first Mass Effect, you choose one of two people to die
right.
The same way, and it ultimately is.
No.
But I guess the
main difference for me is when those four decisions come up in Walking Dead, you're not like, oh, always press Y take the top choice because that's the good choice. And that's what diminished the Mass Effect 3 for me in terms of the decision making is
all three Mass Effects.
Yeah, I wasn't really making decisions. I was like making a good or bad decision and gathering information, and or if I had crewed enough little widget points, I could make a really good decision or a really bad decision.
But let us not overlook what you're doing the rest of the time outside of selecting dialogue choices in either game. So in Mass Effect, you are selecting dialogue choices during exposition scenes and having these exchanges with characters. But then you're running around with your character in full control, adventuring, shooting things, you know, firing off spells, using your biotics, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In The Walking Dead, you're never taken out of the storytelling engine, right? You're always in that storytelling engine. Yes, you move around some, but you're never, it's not like you're going from one engine to another. It's not like you're being taken out of the narrative. You're constantly in the narrative flow. And so it is much more story-like. It is much more like you are pulling strings to change what happens within the thread of the story, as opposed to trying to weave some sort of story of your own, which was what Mass Effect aspired to, and probably why we felt like it didn't achieve it, because when it got to the end of it, we realized, well, we weren't stitching together shit.
Although they could have had, I think, a better effect had they disguised their choices and decisions so that instead of going, hey, player, you want to be the good guy, right? Pick this one. It's, you know, every time the wheel of options is randomized, every time you play through that conversation, you actually have to look at all the options and go, oh, yeah, and then maybe reword them so it's not like, yes, I'm a good guy, or no, I'm an evil dick. You know, it's like...
Well, Walking Dead also had that time limit, so you couldn't even analyze your choices.
Right.
So that's like, the whole thing is you were making those, you were pulling those strings. You're like, ping, and pull a string.
And then you immediately like, oh my God, how's he going to take that?
I think to your point, Garnet, what modern role-playing games have, I think, always aspired to is to simulate the experience of being at a table with a dungeon master who is weaving a tale through your interactivity. Yeah. And trying to create a system where a computer program can convince you of that. That's why people get so enamored with games that have multiple endings and all these things. It's the idea that it's not preordained. My input is weaving a tale that is my own. And I think that's where role-playing games have always gotten their inspiration, is the human being sitting there improvising a story based on how you interact with it. And also, I mean, a lot of ways, you know, that's the vestige also of D&D, of like, am I lawful good? Am I,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas Walking Dead obviously comes from a different place. It's not attempting to do that. It's attempting to tell a story that you participate in. But, you know, I was more engaged in the story in Walking Dead because I put myself in that. I didn't feel like I was role-playing, but I really behaved in a way, bless you, behaved in a way that was what I felt like I would do were I in that situation, which is what role-playing is, you know, is like, well, based on the
based let me ask on you a question. Have you played Persona at all?
No. Everyone says I should, but I really don't.
It is.
I bought it for the PS2, and I played it for like a minute and a half.
So ridiculously good.
It's like, I mean, playing that game for a minute and a half, or 5 minutes, or even 3 hours, you're not even out of the tutorial shit
I
yet.
Know.
It's typical.
I got Terra to play, bro.
It's 6 hours. It's 6 hours to where it opens up.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The reason I asked this question is because I'm now like 11 hours into it, and man, first of all, haters hate all you want about it being a PS2 remake or whatever. I'm pretty confident, and maybe it's because it's also the game that I'm playing now, but I really, really love it. Like, it would probably be my game of 2012 if it weren't for the fact that we were not including remakes in there. Yeah, I really, really, really love this game, and I really wish I had played it on PS2, and like, you could knock it and say, oh, well, it's a PS2 game, you should have played it then, bro. But it's so like what I love. And here's one of the things, like, you're talking about role-playing games. The reason I'm tying this together is this. What is wonderful to me about this game is that it takes what many role-playing games consider to be downtime, in other words, the time that you're not adventuring in combat, and turns it into a vibrant part of the game, a super vibrant part of the game.
That's awesome.
That really figures into... that and not just a vibrant part of the game that is as if it stands on its own, but it's really cohesive because all of the things that you're doing in the outside of combat time, where you're building your personal relationships and building, they basically took all the stuff that you would think of a lot of times in game in combat and adventuring game and just move it into its own segment. So the part that you like about like building relationship with other characters, instead of having to try to do that in combat and battle, you're doing that in normal social situations. And all the parts about like building up your knowledge and your other attributes, you do those in normal social situations. And it's so freaking awesome because you have like this great rhythm and pace now between like, I go to school, I spend a few days studying, I go out in the town, I go have some dinner, I go read some books, I do all these things that are all contributing to who my character is. And then when I go and actually go into the world where I'm adventuring, all of those things come into play because I've been working on them, right? And maybe they resulted in some great persona I was able to craft because I got bonuses because I had invested the time to level up my personal relationship with one of the other characters. Or maybe I've like increased my knowledge, maybe I had to increase my knowledge so that I would have a new relationship open up so that I'd be able to get even a better relationship and have like a better persona I could build. But all these things work together. And so instead of feeling like I'm wandering around during the downtime just waiting to get to the next time to play, I'm actually balancing it out. It's like I'm looking at, and it's cool because the whole thing is so elegantly designed because there is a clear timeline that is the weather that lets you know when you absolutely categorically have to go back to adventuring. But beyond that, within that, it gives you a window of how much time do I want to go spend dungeoning and how much time do I want to spend messing around with my friends and studying and going to drama club and hitting on this girl and all those sorts of things. And it's so, oh, it's so good.
And one only thing I would add to that, which is would seem like a pretty minor thing, but it actually isn't because of the type of game it is the storytelling, the writing and the voice acting in that game are...
It's really good.
It's really good. And it's like head and shoulders above any JRPG I can think of off the top of my head. Really, really funny, like, chuckle-worthy, but like genuine humor. And I mean, it's not the same, like,
well, I mean,
standard,
it does,
like,
it does,
super.
It does,
they do have bits of melodrama
they
in there.
Fall in some characters too. I mean, like Yosuke is pretty much,
yeah, but
he's that character.
But you don't know that until like the way that they reveal that, I think, is really clever. Like they'll build up to that. You don't immediately, it's not, here's an archetype for you. It's like, oh, okay. Oh, wow. This is this, you know.
And I could actually argue that the voice acting for Chie is a little ADV anime at times.
Okay, maybe just because I'm an anime fan, but
I like anime too.
But I think if you compare it against other JRPGs, it's pretty strong.
It's very strong. It's really good, Jeff. You really should play it. It's really good. You really should at least put 6 or 7 hours to get to the point where it really opens up,
is
and
it
then
the,
make this in.
Persona 4 Golden is Vita only.
Yeah,
yeah. If you have,
you can still
Vita.
Go back and play the PS2 version.
Yeah, no, my one of my really good friends, every time I go to her house, that's what I do. I watch her play.
It's so good. It's so good. And I would love to see designs learn from it and think about how can we take these systems that we've always thought we had to abstract and just put on menu screens and pull them out and do them as an actual part of the game. So, I mean, I'm thinking like this is like just off the top of my head, but I'm thinking about like a Diablo where you've got, or even more so a Torchlight, where you've got these huge, awesome skill trees, right? How could I take building up those skills and make them an interesting part of the game that I was playing? You want to have non-combat gameplay? That was a non-combat part of the gameplay that I could be investing in my character and really building that connection with my like role-playing self in the game and not just like arbitrarily picking up Lightning Spell 3.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the big things that I take away from Far Cry 3 is how wonderfully those carrots on sticks lead me to other aspects of the game that I want this thing that helps me do, you know, raid a camp.
Yeah.
So I go and do other stuff
right.
That isn't raiding a camp because I'm excited about raiding the camp.
I really like that game too, by the way.
It's a spectacular game. And I want more games to make a ecosystem of rewards that feels more balanced so that I'm incentivized to go do things that are fun in and of themselves, but that lead me to other areas. And it's sort of this like give and take of like, well, that leads me to that, which leads me back to this, which leads me back over here.
And even the stuff that's like in the same ballpark as like kill 5 rats or whatever is still very well executed. And you don't ever feel like, oh, I'm going to go grind or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm I'm going to get that new holster and, you know, let me find a good hunting ground. And
where does where does Catherine rank as far as having those separate worlds? Because, you know, you're at the pizza place and you can talk to people and you can
puzzle. I really liked everything about that game except for the actual puzzle-based gameplay.
That was the hardest part for me.
Presentation.
I had to die enough so I could unlock easy.
Yeah.
It's a bit of an abstraction. I mean, it's like, that's not really an RPG. It's more of like, it is a weird...
It's a puzzle game.
Catherine is a cool game.
Yeah. I will say this. It led to a very amazing cosplay that I saw.
Oh, really?
The dude with horns and a pillow.
All right, then. All right, that sounds like a good spot to... sounds like a good spot to head to finishing moves. That's what she said.
It's the weekend, and it's time for Finishing Moves.
All right. You know what? I'm going to kick off. So over the holiday, while I was playing Persona, Ariel grabbed a 3DS and picked up Ocarina of Time, which she, come to find out, has played now four times all the way through.
Wow.
And she, like...
Zelda super fan.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly speed run, but I think she finished it somewhere in the neighborhood of like 9 hours or so of game time total. And she's like, I'm like, how are you going to do that fast? She's like, well, I played it four times. Like, oh, okay.
See, if you take away the like, I know how to do the puzzles and I know where to go in Zelda games. Yeah, you're probably 8 or 9 hours.
Right. So, which leads me to my thought that I was a little perplexed about, that I'm interested to hear what you guys who listen to the show out there have to say about it. So drop by the thread and tell me what your thoughts are on replaying games, and specifically replaying games to that extent. Replaying games to the extent where you know where everything is, you know where all the puzzles are, you know exactly how to go through them. Like, how does that strike you? Ariel loved it. Like, she was having the best damn time going back through it. And I just don't... That's never... I've never had the urge to do that. The closest I've ever come was... After I finished, so the first time I played Deus Ex, I didn't finish it. The second time I played Deus Ex, I finished it all the way through to the rocket launching stage and all that kind of stuff. And then the third, I tried to play it again, but I just couldn't do it because I'm like, yeah, I've done it. And I know there are other ways to do it. And that's a game that has other outcomes even. I was like watching her play this. I'm like, well, you know where everything is and how to do everything.
Watch a movie that you know every line of.
That's her argument.
Yeah.
That is her argument. Which I sort of get, except that watching a movie is a passive, like, watching experience, and playing a game it still has that degree of,
But it becomes more passive if you know it inside and out.
Like, I guess.
But yeah, you're right. It is different.
I do the exact same thing with the exact same game. Ocarina of Time is one of the only games where I will play over and over and over again.
Must be a girl thing.
Or a Zelda thing.
Or a Zelda thing. I don't know. So I'm really curious to see what people think. And if you were, you know, am I missing out something by not being compelled to replay games of that nature, like back through again. There you go. That's my finishing move.
That's a good one.
Jeff Mattis.
Yes. Well, my finishing move is, I guess I'm a little late to the party on this one because everybody at this table has played it except for I just recently got my hands on it. But there's a little game called Cards Against Humanity that that I have to bring up. And part of the reason I'm bringing it up is because...
No board games.
Yeah, I know. It's
no MMOs, no board games.
So I was looking for it. Like, I was doing some looking for board games. Jeff, you'd be proud. I was looking for some stuff to play and came across the game on Amazon, of all places. And I was
the only place you can get it.
Well, so I was like, oh, this looks interesting. And I look, and there's none on Amazon for sale. They're all sold out. And the second... party retailers are all selling it for like between $60 and $80. It's a $20 game.
Yeah.
What the developers have done is they have put a PDF on their website that is the full game, or the, you know, minus the two expansions, that you can take to a Staples and print out on cardstock for about $10 and get your own copy of the game.
Well, I'll blow your mind a little bit. There's a whole bunch of print and play games. It's a whole genre.
Oh, no. I am aware of that. I was just stoked to find out that this $80, should have been $20 card game was now ostensibly free plus printing costs. So
also,
paper dolls.
The very cool thing that they did for Christmas is they came out with a Christmas expansion, and it was pay what you can, and it was to charity. Very cool of
that's
them.
That's super awesome. Well, thank you very much for that contribution to the finishing move. Because anyway, so it's a crazy game where it's basically like build your own jokes sort of game. So it's a party game. You got a bunch of people sitting around a table. One person flips up a question, and you have to, you know, basically play a response from your hand of really, really, really messed up responses. Some vanilla, some pretty left field, and it basically just creates some really hysterical. You know, the person who gets the quote unquote funniest one gets a point. It's pretty neat. Anyway,
Mr. Jeff Cannata.
Reminds me a little self-serving. I should have made a bigger deal about this early in the show, but Christian Spicer and I have another double jump coming up.
Double jump.
Boom.
It is January 11th in Los Angeles. Not at UCB this time. We had previous ones at UCB. This time it's going to be at Nerd Melt at Meltdown Comics. And it is a stellar, stellar lineup. I'm so excited. We have... An actress from Buffy. We have Kumail Nanjiani, who's one of my favorite stand-up comedians. And it looks like we're getting Chris Hardwick himself, the Nerdist, on the show. If you have any ability to get to L.A., I highly recommend it. I think it's going to be our biggest and best one.
Who do you have from Buffy? Is that secret?
No, I just can't remember her name. I'm so bad.
Do we need tickets?
Christian set up that guest, and I'm horribly misinformed. Having never watched Buffy, I know. I have to turn my geek card.
What?
I never watched that show.
What?
I know.
You are a fail.
My uppance will come on stage at Nerd Melt.
Do you need tickets to go? And if so,
you
where
do
can
need
you
tickets. You can buy them. Check the check out. You know, follow me at jeffcannata.com with two N's and one T. And I will. I have, and I will again. Or follow Christian also at Spicer. We have links to send. Or you can go to Nerd Melt's site if you just Google the Nerd Melt. They have tickets on sale there. I think it's only $10.
Or you can just send me a lot of money. I don't have anything to do with the show, and it won't get you a ticket. But
it's
like
an
money.
Option you have.
Yeah. No.
So January 11th in Los Angeles, and the Nerd Melt showroom is at 7522 Sunset Boulevard. So it's
in the back of a comic book store. The best place to go for any kind of show.
Yeah.
You can't beat that. So awesome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic, dude.
It's gonna be fun.
It's going to be a big show.
Do you have her name on there so I'm not a complete ass?
I will look it back up, and I just closed it. I'll look it back up while Nicole gives us hers.
Yeah, so mine was going to be go read Ready Player One because I had just read it. But then Jeff, Jeff Two Ends One T just ruined it. So actually, it just was that, but now I'm going to add something else.
Foiled.
Yeah, since you're plugging Nerd Melt, my friend is signing his comic book, Jim Fustante and James Asmus. James Asmus writes Deadpool right now. They are going to have a comic book launch on January 9th at Nerd Melt.
So just stay there for 3 days.
They have...
and do both.
Yeah, great parking, lots of parking around that you can totally keep your car out for 3 days. So just keep in your car.
There's one thing Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles is known for.
Three-day parking.
It is.
Parking that's longer than 2 hours.
And you have none other than Miss Amber Benson.
Amber Benson.
On your show.
Thank God I'm not a complete...
Wow. I'm kind of disappointed that you didn't...
She's awesome. She's super awesome.
That would be Tara. You got to watch... Dude, I can't believe you haven't watched at least the first four seasons.
Well, I watched the first season, and everybody's like, well... The first season's terrible. And I'm like, well, then
that's like saying, play Final Fantasy 13. It's good after 25 hours.
I know. I turn on my geek cred card.
It gets so good after you realize you forget it sucks.
Yeah.
All right, we got to close it down. We're going to close her down. But we still have three tailgates to come this season. Actually, four.
Let's do it.
But we're getting down to the end. So wild card weekend approaches. If you're not sticking around for football, thanks for joining us, everybody. That is your first weekend confirmed for 2013, and we are Ghost. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Work so hard that you know we play harder. For me to see what was going down, my body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hear me with another round. I gotta feel she's ready. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. heading into the playoffs.
Playoffs?
Playoffs.
Playoffs.
Nicole looks at us like we're freaking out. All right, starting up with a little housekeeping and business here at the end of the season. First of all, congratulations to the winners of the first annual Weekend Confirmed Fantasy Football Leagues. After great season runs, I didn't win either
of
those.
Did you choke at the end?
I fell asleep.
And we got to have mad props too. Oh, go ahead.
The West goes to Harbossum. Harbossum beat the one who knocks to take that league. The high cholesterol's in third, putting my ghosts in the lowly fourth place. And the East goes to Warhammer Forte K, who beat my damn team. Nice. Literally beat my damn team. Captain Comeback took third over forgetting Brandon Marshall. So we will be back next year with fantasy football again, with Jeff Cannata playing for the season.
Football.
Yes.
You're gonna play next season?
I am.
You're gonna commit to this and play?
Yes.
No more like I'm on the wrong draft room.
I
don't know what happened.
Anyway.
And then next congratulations go to Dave Del Rio, maybe.
All right, Dave.
The season winner of the Pick'em contest.
And he did it with his team.
Yes, he did.
Kicking the shit out of my team. And I owe him booze. We made a side bet.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So he takes the season 28-19-1 over a duo there at 26-21 of Andrea and Jeff Cannata. Engineers and guests have come in at 25-22, James Stevenson at 24-23, and yours truly down there a lowly 20-27. It's a pretty bad season.
Whammy.
Pretty bad season. So let's do it, folks. Wild card weekend coming up. We got four games. We're going to go through them very quickly. I sound like I'm doing the
traffic on the fives and tens.
The auction. The auction for Storage Wars or something. So first up, we have Cincinnati riding high going into Houston
who's riding low.
Who's been struggling quite a bit. Struggling. And Houston's still a pretty strong favorite here. Houston, 4.5 point favored in this game. I think that they're going to have the Texas collapse just like the Cowboys did.
It's already happened.
I'm with the Cincinnati Bengals on this one. I'm take the 4.5 points.
Right there with you.
Jeff Cannata taking the 4.5 points. Nicole, you get to wrap us up. You're the last. Nicole's analysis comes at the end. Jeff Mattis.
Cincinnati.
And in the booth, we have Dave with. Dave is taking the Texans, and Micah is taking. He's going to go with the Texans also. So Cincinnati out here, Texans in there. And now Nicole.
All right. So I feel like the Bengals, they've been playing a strong game. But you know what? They seem tired. And I think that the line, they're just not going to hold the line. And we're going to see the Houston. We're going to see them pull through.
The Houston what?
Texans.
Okay. Good. I wasn't sure. You kind of trailed off there for a second.
I got it right.
It was good. No, you're good. Very good.
So in that first tilt, Andrea went with the Texans, and Stevenson's with us on the Cincinnati Bengals train. Then comes Andrea's Minnesota Vikings
rematch
in a rivalry matchup. I mean, look, you got to love a rivalry matchup in the playoffs.
Yeah, third meeting in one season. That's pretty fun.
Minnesota going into Green Bay. Green Bay, a 7.5 point favor in this game. I'll tell you right now, Andrea is, of course, Vikings all the way. She bleeds purple and gold. James is on the Green Bay side. Jeff Cannata, where are you on this one?
I don't see any way. I don't see any proof that Green Bay can stop Adrian Peterson. He ran for what 199 last week and 217 or something like that. The week that he's played before,
a freak of nature.
So
how do you come back from a double knee injury? Like his knee injury. How do you come back?
He's
like
a beast. I'm taking Minnesota, and at 7.5 is way too much. I think Minnesota comes in strong, or at least doesn't lose by that much.
do we have a weather report for that?
I don't.
The tundra.
I don't. I'm not giving you one yet because that would be unfair competitive advantage.
Oh,
so.
or somebody with a weather channel access. Oh shit. Well, that 7.5 points is a lot, but the tundra could be frozen.
Well, I can give you a reprieve for a minute because Jeff Cannata already that was exactly what I was going to say. Literally exactly what I was going to say. So I'm Viking. Like Adrian's just. It's ridiculous right now.
Yeah.
And they're not making mistakes. And their defense is playing well. And
they can't seem to tackle him.
I'll go against the grain and go with Green Bay.
And somewhere plan B is like, you bastards.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all right, Billy. You're not here. We are. In the booth, who are you guys going with? Minnesota for Micah and Green Bay for Del Rio and now Nicole.
I think this is going to be definitely a heated match. I mean, you're both teams with a lot of emotion in this. And
there probably will be heaters on the side of the lines.
Well, knowing the weather, I hope so. But I think because of that weather, we're going to see Green Bay have an advantage here. And I think that when, you know, push comes to shove and there'll be a lot of both, you know, emotions are going to get high. And I think that Green Bay is going to pull through.
Sadly, like, sounds just like the NFL Network. It kills me. Then the next two games, we got Indianapolis Colts going into Baltimore, and it's Baltimore favored by 7. Will be Ray Lewis's last game.
Wow.
I think that the Baltimore Ravens, to me, just look like a mirror almost to the Texans. Just not keeping it together, not on a roll, and they're facing an Indianapolis team. Again, look how hungry Indianapolis was against Houston. They took it to him and they look good, and like
he's good.
The luck in the RG3, he's real. So I'm with Indy. I'll take Indianapolis in the 7 points.
I would like to point out that you have picked the visitor underdog in all three.
I know, it's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a crazy weekend.
I'm going Baltimore. I think they win this one for Ray Lewis. I think it's an emotional game.
It's an emotional game.
He, you know, they don't want him to go out like this. They're at Baltimore. I think that I'm taking the Baltimore Ravens.
And that's where I am too, actually, Baltimore.
All right. And in the booth. Oh, wow. Micah says Ray Lewis grew up down the street from him. So he's going with the Ravens and a little emotion there, feeling a little family love. And Del Rio. He's like talking about it. He's talking about Ray Lewis's announcing contract that he's already signed with ESPN, which is kind of hilarious. So who are you going with? He's going with the Colts. And Nicole's been bursting at the seams for this one. She's got a good one. She's going lined up.
You know, I think this is going to be a tough game. And I think that whereas Ravens might have a better defense this weekend, I think that the Colts just want it more. And I think they're going to take it.
Love it.
I do too. It's so good. It's
so amazingly good. And then finally, the one that Dave's been dreading, the Seattle Seahawks go into Washington.
Giving up 3.
And it's a road favorite. Yeah, that's right, Dave. It's Washington plus 3. And, well, let's make Dave choose first. Who are you going to go with, Dave?
I wonder.
He almost wants to. He's saying he almost wants to root against the Seahawks so they'll win. But of course, he's going with his Seahawks.
He's going Micah, Wilson.
Mike, which way are you going? He's going with the Seahawks as well. You know what?
Crazy.
Cowboys fan, NFC East fan or not, 8-game win streak.
Yeah.
No one has shown any ability to slow down that pistol read draw. I don't know why. Like the read option, it's like, guys, it's a read option. Like it's something University of Nevada has been running for forever, but. No one's stopping it, and
if it was in Seattle, it'd be a different story.
And just like there is something to be said for that, the emotional component and that like getting on a roll and feeling good, and that Redskins team right now is feeling it, and especially at home in front of even though they're in Landover and not in RFK anymore, like it's still gonna be loud. It's going to be a home crowd.
I tell you what, if I could only
Hasn't traveled well.
If I could only watch one game this weekend, it would be that one. Luckily, I'm going to watch all of them. But I think this is going to be a really good game to watch.
Those are the makings of being a great game. So which way are you going, Mr. Kanata?
Washington. I'll take Washington the points gladly. Well. And I think they're going to win outright, too.
And
I'm also going with the Skins primarily because I don't know that you can. I mean, that streak's got to end eventually, right?
But I would love another chance.
You're going with the Skins? Or you,
Seahawks.
You think the streak is going to continue?
Oh, yeah. No, that's sorry. Yeah, I phrased that incorrectly. Skins, yes.
And now Nicole wraps it up for us.
You know, I think that I've been impressed with the Seahawks. I'm going to start over. I've been impressed with the Seahawks' performance. And I'm actually surprised that they made it this far in it. And a part of me is rooting for them because they're kind of an underdog in my heart, but I just think that these are the two teams that could, if you would, and I think that the Redskins are going to take it at home.
There you go.
All right.
The matchup of young quarterbacks.
Indeed.
Both of them have carried their teams. I just think RG3 is going to carry his all the way through. All right, folks, you will get us back next week, but not me. I will be at CES, but I'll send you my picks for the first round of the divisional playoffs. You guys have fun.
Yeah, you have fun. Try not to...
Can't wait to see what you get us.
Yeah.
What I get you. I'll just bring everybody home 4K televisions. I think they can hand them out like popcorn.
I heard that here. You heard that here. It's on. It's recorded.
Yep, it's on tape.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I hope you have had a great holidays. Thanks very much for joining us, and we look forward to a great 2013.